If we could come to order, I'd really appreciate it. The purpose of our meeting this morning is to receive a briefing from the National Prosecuting Authority on their budget, their strategic plans, and their objectives. We have this briefing until lunchtime. This afternoon we will receive a briefing from the Special Investigating Unit. Advocate Simelane, welcome. DG Sindane, welcome. Advocate Simelane, I'm going to ask you, as I did yesterday, to please introduce your team so that at least we have some indication of who is with you, and then we'll proceed from there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairperson, honorable members and colleagues. Chairperson, on my right, I have Advocate Jiba, the Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions. She's responsible for strategy and operations in the NPA. On my left is Advocate Nomvula Mokgatla. She is responsible for legal affairs. To her left is our Head of Communications, Ms. Makeke Bulela Makeke. On the far end of the table, on your right-hand side, Mr. Chair, is Haneka from our Corporate Services. She's assisting us with the presentation on the budget. Next to her is Karen van Rensburg. She's responsible for, currently in extra capacity, responsible for putting together the strategy and coordinating it for us. Next to her is Marlies Potgieter, who's responsible for the performance-related information. Next to her is Dr. De Vier, who's our acting CEO, responsible for corporate services that support us. Gordon Holloway is our head of finance, and Annika works under him, and they assist us deal with the budget information, and the DG Ms. Sindane, the accounting officer, is also here. So that is the team chair. I propose to present quickly through the slide presentation so that we enable the honourable members to have enough time to ask questions. The slide presentation was provided, and I'll go through it, Chair, with your permission. Thank you very much. The JPS, on slide two, the JPS delivery agreement covers those eight outputs that we are mandated to deal with. So the context of our presentation and everything that we do is in the context of those eight outputs, which are now widely known. The specific activities that we confine ourselves to doing involve a couple of those specific activities, but primarily we are continuing to refine our processes so that we are able to produce better information, we are able to produce reliable information, and we are able to achieve our business. So we will keep re-engineering and modernizing our business processes, and really what it means that, you know, the directives that get issued from time to time to deal with the various prosecutorial activities are the ones that should be looked at and continuously refined and changed if necessary. The members will know of those changes because if there's any change to the prosecution policy, those changes must be submitted to Parliament. Currently, there hasn't been really any that has been formalized and finalized in that fashion. All the proposed changes are still being discussed and vetted internally in the NPA. We intend to finalize 2% more cases per annum between now and 2014. And you'll see later on in the slide presentation what 2% per annum is in numerical terms, as far as what number of more cases will be done per annum and per month. Ben reduced the backlog by that much by 2014 as well, and then 20% increase in the number of cases dealt with by all means, including alternative dispute resolution. Continuing on the activities, you've seen that information from last year. Again, it's based on the delivery agreement. We want to ensure that by 2014 we have 100 people convicted who are involved in criminal activities, specifically corruption, and who have benefited by receiving assets to the tune of 5 million and above. And those assets must also be restrained. So that 100 people relates to people who've made 5 million and above from the corrupt activities. The slide 5 is the structure. I've tried this time around to present it slightly differently. It's exactly the same as what we presented last time we appeared before the committee. Honourable members raised questions seeking clarity on what was understood is that doing away with certain units, and we thought there was a misunderstanding that that happened then. But this is the structure, as you can see. The whole of the yellow bit is the office of the NDPP. It's now got those four deputies previously didn't have because they were not appointed by them. And you can see that the office of the NDPP has those four specialized units that are assigned to be dealt with by one deputy. They're over there. Then the rest of the other things remain in place. Then that slide showing the DPPs. Those are the offices of the NPA at each seat of the High Court. As you know, we have them in the provinces. And then we have the DG as the accounting officer there and the acting CEO. Then what I've done is that on slide 6, I'm showing you what the NPA looks like in each office where it is situated. So each DPP office has a structure like this. What you have there is that, as I indicated last time again, that we broke down our prosecutors into those components so that they're able to deal with those types of cases in a dedicated fashion. All cases that come out of those units are dealt with in a dedicated fashion. So you'll see there that there's the coordinator for the SCCU. So the misunderstanding, I think, that took place last time was that it was being disbanded. Actually, it wasn't. What we're saying is that it will be reflected in that way in each DPP office, as opposed to saying it is in the NDPP office in the provinces as well. So structurally, nothing has changed, but we think this way of presenting it will avoid the misunderstanding that took place last year. The dotted line for the FU, as you can see, is that the scheme is that in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, the FU reports directly to the office of the NDPP in all of the offices of the NPA in the country. So that's why there's a dotted line there instead of having a direct line below the DPP. The process that we followed in preparing the strategic plan, those bullet points indicate all the issues that we took into account and all the people that were consulted in arriving at this strategic plan. So it's quite an involved and extensive process. On the strategic goals that we have to indicate as per the National Treasury guidelines, the primary aim, remember, of the JCPS outcome is to ensure that all people of South Africa are and feel safe. So everything that you do must have as an outcome that feeling. People will tell you that some of those feelings are subjective, so there will be differences of opinion and so forth and so forth. But generally, the mood must be such that people have confidence in our government, have confidence in our JCPS cluster, so they must feel and must be safe. So we want then as the NPA to focus narrowly on our core mandate, which is to make sure that our prosecutions are effective and the related services that talk to those prosecutions are dealt with effectively. So measurement of time, efficiency is going to be an important thing. Well, the purpose of those strategic objectives is as indicated there. We ensure that justice is delivered to everybody, and that we pay attention to victims of crime and not forget them as part of our process. What I then ask at this stage, Chairperson, is to ask Karen to then take over the presentation and deal with those strategic objectives. There's six of them, and we sought to try and break down the numbers and indicate again the percentages that we believe we can achieve the targets by this coming financial year and in each year up until 2014. And then we'll answer questions from the current.
Thank you, sir. We have presented, as you know, to the National Treasury Guidelines, a strategic plan that will cover the 5-year period. So the presentation is dealing with those aspects. But you also have to develop an annual plan in your first year. That is also titled the annual plan. And in the annual plan, there's a lot more detail. So we followed the recent template of the National Treasury Guidelines, and it does then make it a little bit different to what it is in the past, as you know, for the different templates. And also, we have used the JCB as the living agreement as the basis for our planning. And in order to achieve what is in there, we've actually had to seriously look at our old indicators, and not the old ones are there, but you also find some new indicators. Of course, the JCB is going to actually require us to relook what we're doing and find more innovative ways to deliver on government priorities. So what we've done in our plan is we've actually first put the JCB as output, and then we state what the NCA strategic objective is to deliver on the JCB as output. And then, of course, our objective statement in terms of the guidelines that we have given them. So in our presentation now, the figures are going to go to the lower level that actually is, and I'll take you through that, and you can actually give them the data that you think is now required. You can't just take percentages, you actually have to give numbers, so the numbers are contained in our annual plan. So for the first objective of the JCB is output, we are reducing serious reported crime, specifically focused around contact and trio crime. As you know, the NPA does not keep data around specific crime types, but we do regard all cases in our regional and our high courts as being serious cases, which fall within this area as mentioned in today's session. So our strategic objective is to increase the successful prosecution of these cases. And we do in fact have a new indicator, which is increasing the number of convictions rather than the number of new cases involved in the regional and the high courts. From our baseline figure that you have later on our documents currently is only 35.7%, and we want to increase that figure significantly by 3% per annum to actually show that we are dealing more effectively with various crimes. If I can go into the second slide, JCB is after two. This is the bulk, or this is the core function of the organization, talking about improving the integration across the JCB cluster, and focusing on finalizing more cases, reducing the backlog, and we also have our target by planning the overall solution. Now you'll note that in our plan, the overall solution rate for the outer years remains constant. However, you will note that these plans, we will maintain this conviction rate in a higher number of cases, because as you said before, there's a standard, no more than 8 cases, which is very, very difficult to keep, you might compromise on that. And it's increasing the number of cases finalized, including ADRM. Cases finalized through verdict are cases that take long, they are the cases that should be dealt with in the court of law, whereas we try to use office dispute mechanisms to resolve cases which we feel don't have to follow the formal justice route, but can be dealt with through the method of restitution and resolving the dispute between the parties. So we are using those figures. As you do know, we do have some problems with the issue of services in that regard, that we are engaging with our partners constantly to provide us with those additional services. After three speaks to dealing with corruption, specifically within the JCB structure, and what we want to do is improve the prosecution of officials charged with corruption. Now, it is so that within the JCB delivery unit, currently there aren't these targets, which is the baseline report that they're already collecting for 2019. We have collected this data, and we are collecting it currently going forward, and we've actually decided to put some targets down for ourselves in terms of that. At the higher level, we say we want to go to 80%, we want to finalize more of these cases. Obviously, if we are effective in impacting on corruption within our organization, within the JCB, what you would like to see in the outer years is actually a reduction in the number of reported corruption cases within the JCC. However, our targets we have set here relate to the current workload that we have on our books and that we are aware of and have been identified within the cluster. And that's why you will see that in terms of the numbers. In our annual plan, we also set targets around the time frames for these cases because we believe that it is imperative that these cases be dealt with speedily. We also have a target in our annual plan in the first of that. If you go to Article 4, this talks about promoting trust and support to victims and to improve the justice system for victims of crime. Obviously, within the JCC's delivery agreement, the main indicator for the NCA is the TCC, which currently stands at 22, that will be increased to 40 over the period. However, in the annual plan, there is also targets for outreach programs, for the looking at the payments to victims of crime, and actually trying to quantify that figure, not just merely numbers, but also looking in terms of the main value, in terms of what we actually focus on giving back to victims of crime, as well as support preparation officers, which we believe provide a service to the victims of crime, making the experience with the JCPS as such a much more pleasant experience, and also empowering victims to actually give evidence in our court. In terms of Article 5, that improving investor confidence and the perception we have, of course, linked to Article 3 relating to the corruption cases. But these are those persons that are called the known perpetrators that have benefited the amount of at least 5 million from the proceeds of crime. And our ideal is to convict 100 people who have at least 5 million assets to spend over this period. And you will also see there in terms of that our various targets in the end to go along and also supporting programs. Of course, the main focus was around the seizing of the assets, which is the lead indicator, and your last indicator will then be the corruption, the actual conviction. And then when you look at our quarterly report, you will see this also has been within our data. Objective 6 is cybercrime and dealing with it. Everyone knows that cybercrime as a tool, cyber technology as a tool to commit crime is on the increase. This requires special skills from the prosecutors as well as investigators and actually a 24-hour capability to be able to detect and deal with these cases. And we all know targets currently other than the development of the travel sequence plan to deal with cybercrime. As an organization, we probably need to build some capacity in our organization so that we can successfully deal with these cyber cases over a period of time. And we will also start monitoring these cases to get an idea and a feel for how many there are on our court rolls and what the appropriate person is dealing with. What we have then in the slide is we take you to the more detail, and this is the number of interest to the party, to the people looking at our plan, and that will tell you the figures. As I said, in terms of Article 1, we want to look at the number of court cases, and we see a thinking of at least 10 years in the code. Now, the argument is that these kind of cases are serious and therefore deserving of the right form of sentence. Obviously, we do not want to cut clog up the prisons, but we do believe that the right people should be within the prisons. Therefore, by reducing backlogs and finalizing cases quicker, the awaiting trial detainees and sections will be addressed and make sure that the prisons and the people that are committing a serious crime in prison as they should be. Convictions in criminal court cases, measured against the number of new cases enrolled. You will see the figures here that we put down for you. For 10-11, it is a projection based on our quarterly data. We made a projection of where we believe it would be, much as one does for the E&E. We are slightly off target in terms of that projection, and that, of course, will impact on our performance going forward. But you will see what we want to do there is to increase that number that is convicted and percentage there as well. Article 2, we talk about the overall conviction rate as I mentioned to you. Just to take note there, in 2010-11, we projected 426,213 cases which will have a conviction. And in 2030, we'll have the same conviction rate, but the actual figure will now be 461,454. There's more cases, but we maintain the conviction rate, so the impact will be better. The number of court cases finalized, including ADRM, that's the total number that finalized in our court. And you'll see the increase there, 2.8% per year, and the increase that goes across there. And this, of course, aligns to the E&E, a form of voter representation for the region. In terms of official charge with corruption, the target for the number, currently we're projecting 32 for the current financial year, the conviction rate is about 76%. and we're hoping to have 100 people convicted by 2013, the cumulative figure, and 80% conviction rate. The value of assets in, we have at the current moment, we're projecting that there won't be any for this current financial year. That was our projection, and we've set ourselves targets going forward. As you know, that in these cases, there isn't always a huge amount of money because the 5 million cases are dealt with out of 5. So these are the remaining cases that we're talking about. In terms of item 4, it's the number of operational TCCs. As we're talking about, they're taking them from 25, which is our target for this year, to 40 within the period. And then item 5 is the serious corruption, which is the one with the 100 people convicted each of which of these 5 million. So we've got the two, the lead and the lag. So there, as you can see, we also indicated in our target how we are showing that to be happening. Item 6, talk to cyber crime, which we would like to have at each of our regions at least 2 people that are dedicated to doing it. However, it is our aim to ensure that every project system has undergone basic training in terms of cyber crime prosecution.
Thank you very much. The next slide will deal quickly with the issues of risk management. Through the Office of the Acting CEO, we conducted an assessment of risks that we believe are up there that we must continuously look out for and try and mitigate as much as possible. So those identified there, the top 5, reflect those that we think we should continue to bear in mind and deal with continuously. They're not the only ones, naturally, but we just think they're the ones to which close attention should be paid based on our past reports and past discussions. The first one that we think has a higher risk rating relates to financial controls and management. I think it speaks for itself because we've already had those challenges. The audit reports have indicated that, and we're addressing those issues as we speak, and we'll give you more details during this presentation. The second risk, we've identified that if there isn't any strong coordination within the JCPS cluster, there is a risk that we may not be able to perform and be as responsive as we ought to be and as we need to be in order for government to achieve its delivery objectives. So, the second risk, absence of and poor coordination within the cluster is one thing that I think is important. And in that respect, we've identified the relationship with the South African police and legal aid in South Africa as being critical because without those immediate partners, we're not going to be able to perform. And we already see this, especially in respect of Legal Aid South Africa in terms of resource allocation. The NPA has more resources than the Legal Aid Board, than Legal Aid South Africa. So as a result, our prosecutors do struggle in court to finalize some matters because some accused remain underrepresented, because there's one Legal Aid official allocated to deal with probably 8-10 cases just that day. So everybody has to wait for that one available person. So we think that's something that, as the NPA, we would submit has to be taken into account and would support more resourcing for Legal Aid South Africa in that respect because it has a direct impact on our delivery. The third one talks to financial resources to enable us to perform. Yes, with austerity measures, there's going to be difficulty for everybody across government and we're affected equally like everybody else. That's something worth noting. More so, if I can say, Honourable Chair, in respect of cases, the litigation in respect of cases, I want to take this opportunity as well to bring it to the attention of the Honourable Members that now in some cases, especially cases that involve people with means, you find them in tax-related cases, you find them in commercial matters, you find them in organized crime matters. People with means have better ways of dealing with the system, and they pump money into their defenses, and that drains the resources. One of those ways is to litigate. I mean, a typical strategy is to
is to attack the search warrant or an arrest warrant. It's to attack the process followed, you know, using constitutional grounds which are perfectly legitimate, but which everybody knows that on that case, on the merits of that case, they're unlikely to succeed. But because people have a right to do so, they do so. But what it does is that it buys time, and it always buys sufficient time for people to be able to deal with the case strategically. So it is important that we are able to respond to that and we're able to fight at least that aspect of the case. Because if you can't fight it, a trial never starts, because there's this interlocutory application of a civil nature waiting to be finalized in court and so forth and so forth. So that's the part of our budget that is not very strong. And historically, it has never been. But with more litigation going on, it's on an upward trend, we believe, and we should note that. At this stage, it's not presenting the type of problem that's not making us perform, but we see it as a risk that we need to start mitigating. The fourth one has always been there and will always be there. It just relates to skills. You know, we have to make sure that we're able to move with the markets. You know, if criminal elements upgrade their skills levels and the resources they employ with higher skills than us, we'll lose. So we try to be on par, if not higher. So that's a continuous one. The freedom of vacancies is a challenge. I continue to engage with the acting CEO quite strongly on this, and I've intervened personally in quite a number of instances to try and speed up the process. And you know, we're getting there, but it can be better. It's not as high, and we've got figures to indicate that. But again, it remains a challenge. So skills and the filling of vacancies is an issue. Linked to the filling of vacancies, though, is something that also is beyond not only our control, but at this stage, from our assessment of the budget allocation, even outside of our accounting officer's control. And that is the issue of accommodation. We don't have space to accommodate prosecutors in the courts. So we're not going to be recruiting all the time, because we don't have the space, typically. Cases in point, Bumalanga, cases in point, Bologwane, and many other areas. So it's not an easy thing to do this, you know. Even if you are using a shared resource, like a shared room, you can only put so many people in a room. So that's also becoming a bit of an issue. Five is that one that relates to integrity. We believe our environment is one where, you know, there'll always be attempts to compromise prosecutors to get an advantage, and we keep emphasizing the point that ethical behavior is important. We can't be the ones prosecuting people for corruption when we have the same problem within our ranks, or pointing fingers at others for unethical behavior when we have the same problem. So we're trying to deal with that. So that's what we have identified. Quickly on the budget, I won't spend too much time. The figures speak for themselves. It's just the allocations that are out there. I'll just highlight the key things. A large part of our budget goes to public prosecutions, as you can see at the top, about 1.9 billion, which is the adjusted appropriation at this particular point in time. And it's got marginal increases going forward. 2011, 2012, you see a slight reduction there. That's occasioned by the fact that the current adjusted appropriation includes OSD. So OSD is going to be a once-off in terms of adjustments, and then it's going to remain on our budget. We got that money for OSD to deal with historical issues. So once it's gone, our budget is going to remain allocated as per 2011, 2013, 2014. Then that public prosecutions talk to all the offices of the DPP in the provinces, basically. Offices of the NPA in the provinces, the DPP offices. So that's money allocated for core business, which is prosecution. So a large part of it is allocated to that, which is great. Then we have witness protection, then we have asset forfeiture units and support services. It is a high number. As you can see, we are trying to make sure that the allocation of resources for support services is evenly spread out. Currently, a large chunk of our admin is a head office, VGM. And that's not where the biggest prosecutions happen. So there is a misallocation there. So we're currently engaging with the Office of the Acting CEO to try and see if we can move some of those resources away. You know, so I think personally that it's a bit of a problem. So we'll deal with that. The overall budget and expenditure, as at 17th of March, when we prepared these financials, as you can see, we've specifically highlighted OSD Phase 2 implementation, which hasn't been finalized and is unlikely to be finalized anytime soon because there's still some work to be done there. Those are the figures that that are available. So if you add 1.9 to 98 million, you get 2 billion plus budget. But it's going to get reduced once we've done with OSD. Then a large part of our budget, yes, goes to compensation of employees. So that's fine. It's paying directly for resources that are there to conduct prosecutions. Then the next biggest is the goods and services, which is broken down into various activities. But largely it's S&T, which is for travel and so forth and so forth. Travel for prosecutors to go to courts and the outskirts. And we'll show how that's broken down per office so that you can see which offices receive a large chunk of the budget. The others, payment of financial assets, households, and machinery and stuff. It's basically our buildings that are leased for us where we occupy. The office of the CEO deals really with that and manages those lease agreements in greater detail. The one that's key and relevant for us immediately is the goods and services budget. Slide 26 at the bottom, we're just indicating the differences, the increase and the decreases on our baseline over the period. So the EME for 2011-2012, that adjustment, the change, is occasioned by the OSD, as I've indicated. Per economic classification, the slide number 27 deals purely with the prosecution parts of the budget. It says NPS overall, but it's just purely the prosecution's part of the business. And as I indicated, that's a large chunk of our budget there. Then, broken down further, head office, which is HQ, that's the budget there. You know, 46 million at this particular point in time goes to headquarters. Goods and services is not much, as you can see there. And then the last column deals with what you've spent to date, what you expect to spend to date. Then DPP office is next. The Bishop office, you can see the budget allocated there. You know, I think, in fact, Bishop office is probably our smallest office. I think that's the budget for compensation of employees, for goods and services, that much, and that's where we are in respect of expenditure. So you can compare the offices. The next one is Bloemfontein. That's what we have for Bloemfontein. Cape Town, a bit more. It's a bigger office, bigger slice of the budget, quite understandably. And you can see the relevant expenditure. Similarly with Grahamstown, you can see the expenditure there. And you can do the comparison. And it's quite nice to do the comparison because you can really see not only the sizes of the offices, you can compare the sizes of the offices, your budget allocation, and then your performance on the cases, and be able to see whether we've allocated the resources nicely. So we're continuously looking at that to make sure that all offices receive what they need to receive to perform. Johannesburg, got a slightly bigger budget. Kimberley, Mabato, one of our smaller offices, you can see there. Grahamstown, I was pleasantly surprised, I didn't think it was, but it made sense when I realized that KZN is the biggest province. So it has the biggest budget and the biggest number of prosecutors as well. And you can compare it to the DPP office Pretoria. It's big in that way, not because it's in the biggest province, whereas Gauteng is not, but it's because it covers Mpumalanga and Limpopo all in one. You know, that's the jurisdiction of that DPP. So until there's a high court in Limpopo and Mpumalanga, that DPP is going to be dealing with cases from those places. So once we've established offices there, we'll be able to deal with that. I must say, and I said this last year as well, the Honourable Member, that it doesn't totally depend as well on the existence of the High Court. If we could get accommodation, we can put the people, because the people are available, and we can start running those offices there, even if you don't necessarily have a High Court. So in other words, you know, we've identified people that are ready to move up, but we just don't have offices to place them. And we've raised that with the accounting officer, and those issues are being looked at. And once those processes are resolved and there's a budget for it, it will be allocated accordingly and we'll set up shop. But what we do in the meantime is that we've sent people to practically squats with other prosecutors in the lower courts and still service in that way, just to make sure that police officers don't send up dockets all the way to Tshwane to get them attended to. They can be attended there. But the best we can do and should do is to have some accommodation to accommodate a few people. So significant progress is being done, and I think within the next month or two, we'll be able to move people there. So it's not going to depend on the High Court per se. And maybe that's the challenge in the legislation, because the legislation says there shall, at each seat of the High Court, be the office of the DPP. So if the legislation could be changed, maybe to say there shall, in each province, be the office of the DPP, to be slightly different, so that it's not so directly linked to that. But it's a historical issue that's always been there, and it's been a policy issue. If that would change, it would be slightly different. But as I said, it's not totally dependent on that. Toyando, the old vendor of High Court, but under the DPP Pretoria jurisdiction, it has the smallest piece of the budget, and then we've got Mthatha. These are the immediate allocations in terms of the medium-term budget allocations per each office, as you can see. We'll deal with specific questions, Chair, as far as the budget is concerned. Now, the issues that were raised last year that I recall, Honourable Members will help us and remind us of those issues as well. Those that I can recall specifically, I haven't seen this parliamentary report, I just got it this morning, so I'll clumsily deal with this, but hope that Honourable Members will assist. But some of the things that I could recall that were raised, just from the audit issues, you'll recall that the acting CEO indicated that a forensic report was going to be obtained. It has since been obtained, and I have seen the outcomes that are and it's not as in the and one of those outcomes from that report of recommendation is that where at least one identified irregular expenditure, those people identified there should be disciplinary action taken. That process has commenced, and the relevant individuals have been asked to in terms of due process, to submit their written representations on why disciplinary action should be taken against them. Once we get their responses, then we follow the process. So the process is underway on all those identified. Another part of that report, we're dealing with by way of identifying where accountability lies, because the forensic reports didn't assist us much in that. But we're using our own information and that report to place liability where we believe it should lie, so that a decision is taken in respect of some of those people as well. So at least if I recall right now, we've identified 18 people have been identified. And regrettably, it includes some of the senior people in the organization. So as we say, the law will follow its course without fear, favor, and prejudice. So that's running. So in a month or two, there will be updates on this. So I'm not sure when how much time people are giving to respond, but they're given 7 days, if I recall. So they'll come back to us. And the names are available if the committee wants to see them, and that report is available if the committee wants to see it. So it really is not a big deal. It's just a straightforward identification. So that is underway. The issue of audits of leave, I've again monitored this with the acting CEO.
There has been a great improvement. I think by the end of the financial year, we would have finalized our audit of all levers as per the audit, and then we'll engage with the auditors to know that they are satisfied or not. Similarly with assets, although we're having some difficulties with assets, and where we believe that people are not compliant, we have again identified them and we taken a decision again that I think this time around people should be disciplined. So we're taking that action, and we do have the names again of those people that I think we can submit them to so that you can see, and we are refining those processes. So we'll engage with the auditors and see what comes out of this. So Dr. Devere will add a bit more on the detail. But as far as what the honourable members were promised to be done, which is taking action against the relevant people, that is being done and is underway. I'm trying to see what other issues came up last year that I forgot. Vacancies, I think you should be able to give the details of that. The Operation Recruitment Drive ran its course, we spent money on it, it got completed. I have reservations about whether or not it was money well spent. I think the process, the way we designed it, got us in a bit of a knot. I think it got a bit too cumbersome. There are far too many posts to be filled within that particular period of time. Colleagues will give the figures and updated figures on what we're able to achieve through that process. But subsequent to it, you'd have seen in the month of February, January and February, we advertised other remaining posts, all other remaining posts, and they're now in the process of being filled with the target date of 1st of June. I personally checked each and every advert. I personally made sure that all of the posts that we want covered are covered. But again, we were hampered by the fact that in some offices we don't have accommodation. So some of those posts will be held back a little bit. But that process of recruitment is ongoing. Colleagues will touch on the exact rates that we're trying to meet. I think that's Chair. I'll request the honourable members to remind us if there's anything else that I've left that was raised last time. One point that was raised that I can make mention of, it came out in the department's presentation yesterday. I thought it talked directly to the MP, the issue of maintenance prosecutors. Currently there's about 71. The legislation, the Maintenance Act, currently defines a maintenance officer to include a prosecutor. So every prosecutor, by virtue of being a prosecutor, is a maintenance officer. Now that's not criminal work, it's civil work. But for purposes of that legislation, the policy direction was to say that prosecutors must assist in dealing with the scourge. So they are assisting, and they're therefore these maintenance prosecutors. What we've done, we've placed maintenance prosecutions as part of specialized prosecutions, if you look at the structure of each DPP office, so that we deal with it as part of all our specialized prosecution areas. So which means all prosecutors are available to do maintenance work. Now the question that we're going to be dealing with more strongly, continuously, is at what stage of the process prosecutors should be involved. The initial policy approach to define maintenance officers to include prosecutors was informed by the challenge that ordinary people face, in that in many cases defendants are able to secure good legal representation, and therefore the resources that plaintiffs had available to them were not always able to match that of the defendants. The ordinary clerks in the courts that are allocated to deal with maintenance work were just not going to be able to match. So it was felt that if prosecutors, at least because of their legal training, could assist, they could sort of balance the scales, as it were.
by the problems and policy-wise, that that's not criminal work. And the question is, should prosecutors be doing that kind of work? Because it's not its core business. You see, that's a management decision. For now, we've left it as it is, but we're engaging with it with a view to see how best we can do this. Now, we've identified that the best time for prosecutors to be involved, really, is when there's a default, and we're seeking to enforce that order by having somebody at least arrested or found in contempt for not complying. That's the best place to use prosecutors, because that's when it's criminal. But there still is a need to deal with it much earlier. So we're assisting maintenance officers and other officials of the department in that regard when there are those complicated matters. But as a matter of course, we are slowly withdrawing our prosecutors from that part of the process to the other parts of the process. That's a better allocation of resources. But the 71 maintenance prosecutors that are there are now not only dedicated to that work, they are part of the broader specialized prosecutions work, but all prosecutors are available to do that work. So we thought that we should increase the resources available by doing it that way, as opposed to just identifying just a few to do that kind of work. That's where I'd like to end, Chair, by way of presentation, and respond to the issues that have come up in the presentation through responses to questions that honourable members I know will definitely have. If maybe Dr. De Vere would like to touch on the issue of vacancies, just to indicate what the rate is at this point in time, if I can allow him, Chair, with your permission.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, NDPP. I think the rate of vacancies at the moment is 15.3%. We moved it. I think we had a vacancy rate about a year ago of 17%. It has now moved to 15.3%. We tried operation recruitment drive. I think under that drive, we managed to appoint about almost 200 people. I think the exact number was about 181 people. But the difficulty with that process, as the NDPP has indicated, is that most of the promotions that were made were internal promotions. In other words, most of the people we appointed were people from inside who just left one position and moved higher up and left vacancies at the lower level. So I think we made very, very minimal number of appointments of people externally. So I think we'll revise our strategy and try and attract more people from outside the organization in order to reduce the vacancy rates. With regard to the issue of the audit action plan, I think the NDPP has covered us. I think we'll just wait for any questions that may arise and address those. Thanks, Chair.
Is there an advocate similarly?
Chair, I think it's fair to leave it at that and deal with issues by way of questions. I think it's fair. Thank you very much. Sorry, Chair, I don't know at what stage the members would wish to raise some of the issues. I thought I should mention that in addition to this and this manner of presentation, there may be a time for the committee to consider discussing some of the issues that we feel are directly impacting on our work that talk to cases specifically. I'm not sure how the honourable members would want to do this in terms of a scheme, you know, but I do believe that there are certain issues that we deal with here by way of policy or maybe by way of strategy, but when they come out in actual cases, it's important to again bring them here so that you know they can be reflected upon. I know it's never been done before, but I do feel that honourable members may be slightly short-changed in getting a picture of what exactly goes on if you don't get a bit of case-related work, especially maybe those at least that have passed, not those that are still running. And I think because they are already in the public domain, there's no issue. But policy issues do come out of cases. And there is a difference between having a particular policy on paper, but you know when it comes to implementation, different things come up. So I just thought I should raise it here so that maybe during the course of the year, once the committee has thought about it, it can advise us how best we can try to do that. We can look at the NPA Act as well. But I just
Doctora should raise it, you know, without necessarily indicating which cases. We can assist by identifying those cases where we think they, we have seen problems, but others are just, I think, simply straightforward. But I thought I should just make that as a suggestion that the honourable members can consider. Thank you, Chair.
All right, I've got Schaefer. Following names in this order. The Honourable Mr. John Jeffrey, the Honourable Steve Swatt, the Honourable Dean Smuts, the Honourable J.V. Sibanyoni, and the Honourable Debbie Schaefer, and the Honourable Dr. Ambrosini, in that order. JJ.
Chair, yeah, thanks. Just to thank the National Director for the input, and I think also on the issue of gender representativity. But look, the first point is really this BRR report from the committee. I was distressed to find out yesterday that the department had not seen it either. You know, I think that I thought the House had adopted. I mean, Treasury definitely responded, told us that they'd responded to the issues raised. I think it's a serious deficiency that neither the NPA or the department had seen it. And it's not up for us to run after you and say, here's this report we've adopted on you. It's up to those bodies to make sure that they're read and up to date. So I don't know what is happening from your parliamentary liaison from either the NPA or the department. Then maybe just to raise one other thing. I mean, we did deal a little bit with vacancies yesterday. I did see a press report on the minister's briefing on the JCPS cluster, and he spoke about the fact that the vacancies would be filled. And the report we've got here is really completely inadequate. I mean, in terms of your annual report, October 2010. You know, let me just read from what the researchers have done for us. If I may, it might be a bit of time, but I just think it's useful. Mario, are you okay with that? Okay. All right. The NPA experienced considerable difficulty in attracting and retaining staff. In 2009-10, there were 500 let me leave that. At the end of 9-10, the NPA had reduced its vacancy rate for prosecutors to 16.3%. Okay. A concerted drive was launched to fill vacancies through Operation Recruitment Drive. At the end of October 2010, the NPA had reduced its vacancy rate to 12.12% for prosecutors. Now, Dr. DeVee is now telling us, no, it's 15.3. It's gone up again, if that figure is correct. Now, this is not acceptable. Okay, if you're going to increase prosecution rates, you've got to have the staff. We all know the problem is in the courts, where you have one prosecutor with too many cases and not being able to prepare properly. So, Chair, I do think we need to, particularly in support of the Minister's statement of the filling of vacancies and also with the department. And I don't think there's a shortage of law graduates out there. There aren't. I do think we need to look at mechanisms for monitoring the filling of vacancies, because it's just not happening. On the retention thing, also the OSD, you haven't spent your money, which may be resulting in prosecutors leaving. So please, can you give us some detail on that? Funds allocated to the second phase of the OSD, you failed to utilize these funds in the last two financial years. What's going on? Then the stats issue, Chair. We did raise problems with the stats. We did, in our budget review report, talk about the need for the department to brief us on a stats mechanism, because it's very difficult following the stats issue. I note, for example, that National Director, that your own figures, you know, are in conflict. Maybe it's just a typo. But the estimates of national expenditure, page 520, those figures are not the same as the figures in your strategic plan. There's a couple of differences. So it just is, Chair, we need to get to grips with the stats. We need to get the department and the NPA to tell us how they determine the stats. Then, one thing on the stats that I'm extremely confused about, on your strategic plan, the first strategic objective is increased successful prosecution of serious crime. There you've got a figure of 45%. Convictions in the criminal court cases measured against new enrollments. 45% is your target. But then other places you're talking about targets of conviction rates of 88%. Now, how can you have 45% of new cases in the regional and high court versus an overall conviction rate later on of 88%? It doesn't make sense. And particularly when you think of regional and high court are not courts of first instance. So the withdrawals should be less. You might have cases enrolled that shouldn't be, and they just get withdrawn because of lack of evidence in the magistrate's court. But by the time they've been referred to the regional and to the high court, there's some kind of case to answer. The withdrawals should be less. Chair, we were very unhappy, National Director, with this informal mediation. We as reference to that in our report. That the increase in informal mediations is reported in the NPA. When you came in October, you gave us figures from 15,207-208 to 68,000 in 2009-10 is worrying, as these are not regulated. And we said attention is to pay to the increase in informal mediations with a view to regularizing or providing appropriate guidelines. Now, what you've done this time is you buried the informal mediation with the ADRM. I mean, and with diversion, which is regulated, okay? And I'm really worried about what's going on. These figures are high. It could be a lazy prosecutor just withdraws the case and then rocks it up, I mean, ratchets it up as an informal mediation matter. There needs to be regulation. The statutory provision for diversion, how it's meant to work. The statutory provision for plea bargaining, which used to happen informally before that. There needs to be, I think, statutory provision for informal mediations, or at the very least, while we wait for the law, guidelines to be followed, because otherwise I'm worried that there's a lot of serious problems. Limpopo and Mpumalanga. Yesterday we were told that the department has a budget and is going to be employing people for both high courts. When are you going to be having a provincial director of Mpumalanga and a provincial director of Limpopo? We're told that there is a rented building for the high court in Limpopo. Where is your offices? Where are your offices in Limpopo as NPA? And don't please come with the superior courts, because both the High Court and the NPA were able to establish Gauteng South and North without any statutory provision. And then just lastly, Chair, the figures for on those charts at the end on the breakdown per province, I see there's quite substantial variances for machinery and equipment. Pretoria NDPP or DPP Pretoria went 1,062% over budget. Pietermaritzburg 689, etc. So just can you explain those? And so, Chair, the very last thing, maintenance. I'm very pleased with the input from the National Director, but the concern I've got is that you've got prosecutors who deal with maintenance, and I think it's very important that you have those prosecutors, that you don't take them and feel that the maintenance officers of the department will do the work, because they're actually prosecuting. They've got more status, and they should get involved in more than just prosecuting, but in terms of the mediation issues. My concern to both the NPA and the department is that those bodies are not structurally talking to each other enough. Okay? So the NPA prosecutors, or the prosecutors, fall under yourself. the maintenance investigators fall under the department and the regional heads. And I would think it's crucial, and I don't think it happens enough, it does in some provinces, not in others, that there's a structured forum of maintenance officials which meets, which discusses, which strategizes, and ensures that they don't overlap and that they pool their resources effectively. And as far as I can see, that's not happening on a structured level, and that's crucial. Thanks, Chair.
NDPP, would you prefer to respond directly or take two or three more rounds of questions?
Chair, may I request that we will respond to each one so that
please do
in case
that.
It's exhausted. I got a sense yesterday that honourable members were comfortable.
I'll monitor the follow-ups. I'll make sure that they aren't, don't get out of control.
Yes. Yes. Chair, I'll start with a few and then I'll let colleagues talk to the others. On maintenance, the honourable member is correct. Because there are these divisions that in law you deal with this aspect and in law the others deal with this aspect, there still is a need to refine precisely when a case can then be transferred from a maintenance officer to the other side, so that we don't step really on each other's toes and then maybe affect the legal process, as it were. So the actual transfer from one to the other is important, especially from the maintenance officers to the prosecutors. So that aspect has to be clearly sorted out. And also, if prosecutors are going to be involved at the beginning, which cases specifically do they then deal with from beginning that the maintenance officer needn't deal with? So that aspect still has to be finalized. I absolutely agree with that process needing an improvement. There is no DPP office in Limpopo because there is no high court. What you have in Limpopo is the circuit court, a permanent circuit court of the Gauteng North. So technically, we don't have a DPP, but what we do have there, Honourable Chair, is a deputy director of public prosecutions who's running that office with 12 prosecutors. So it's correct, the department did provide us with that space, and we do have a group of prosecutors working there. And it's working wonders for the police there because they don't have to go to Pretoria. We're just trying to do the same from Mpumalanga. Hopefully we'll get that sorted out. The last feedback that we had received from the acting CEO was the finalization of relevant leases for Mpumalanga. So that's what I'm saying. At least in the next month or two, we're expecting to be able to move people in, if not even sooner. So it is definitely is underway. The prosecutors have been identified who will move in there, so it's not a problem. Informal mediation, just to update, the other member is correct. There is no policy, there is no regulation. But I am aware that the department is finalizing the relevant policy. The JCPS cluster was briefed on that policy, I think it's January or February meeting. I think it was a February meeting. I was at that meeting. We were briefed that the policy is being finalized. And in fact, the DGs in that cluster approved the version that was there. So as soon as the department is able to formalize it and finalize it in accordance with the processes, we'll then have the policy that the Honourable Member is talking about. And it is a correct concern that some of those matters are actually getting resolved. There are checks and balances in place because mediation is not for certain types of offences anyway. So you'll find it in largely minor matters. Most of the time, in domestic violence related cases, regrettably, purely because between the parties themselves, sometimes they just insist that they won't cooperate. So it's a bit difficult in domestic violence cases. And we are not always able to insist on a prosecution. We try, but not always. So we manage that. We do check, just so that honourable members are also comfortable, we do spot checks now and again to see certain cases. Whether or not they were dealt with correctly, we have found. In fact, I did find one case that was reported to me from KZN by the acting DPP, where for some reason, and we're still investigating how it happened, and I'm hoping to get a report very soon now. But the draft information that I've received wasn't enabling me to understand exactly what happened. But it's a case that is a murder case that was somehow resolved by way of restorative justice. And somebody paid money, I think 150,000, to the victims, you know. So, so, you know, in our spot checks, we do find questionable places, and for me, this one is probably the most that stands out, you know, because it's a clear murder, and the accused paid the deceased family 150,000. So we're following up to try and find out under what circumstances they accepted that, you know, because they did receive the money and they walked away. So we monitor it. It won't always be perfect, and I think all of the members must expect that some cases will slip between the cracks, and the sooner we know of them, obviously, the better. But as a matter of approach, mediation doesn't involve serious cases. Diversion, I forgot to mention earlier in the presentation, now that the honourable member has raised this, I must mention it. When we presented Quota 3 statistics, you'll recall that we indicated that there were 218 Schedule 3 diversions in terms of child justice, I think, here in Cape Town. We indicated a huge figure of those diversions, and the honourable members, Honourable Jeffrey in particular, raised a concern about that if it was correct and that we should just double check it. We did go back, as I undertook we would, and I'm pleased to announce that in fact it's not true. We've checked with each of the DPPs to find out, because in terms of the Child Justice Act, each DPP must authorize a Schedule 3 diversion personally, and none of them has authorized a Schedule 3 diversion, so we don't have those cases. Why the office is confused was the initial stages of the process. In other words, the initial stages of preliminary investigations and assessments by social workers, they counted those as diversions. Because technically, when you look at child justice cases, we look for diversions. So people immediately take it, as soon as we begin the process of assessment, we are starting a diversion process. Whereas what we wanted them to report on was the final signed off diversion as a matter of finality. So there's none of those. So most of those cases, the numbers are correct for preliminary assessment cases. So as an indicator of Schedule 3 cases involving the youth, the numbers are correct. But what was not correct was the stage. What you had then were preliminary assessments being done. So most of those cases, as we speak, are running in trials. In other words, they were rejected. So which means Schedule 3 cases involving youth are continuing to be prosecuted. So what we've decided to do is to pay close attention to those to make sure that it's cases where we have not overlooked exceptional circumstances, because that is the test. You divert if there are exceptional circumstances. So we are still finding poor people, youth from poor backgrounds committing serious crime, but so far we are not finding exceptional circumstances in their cases to justify diversion as a permanent solution to that particular case. So the assessment gets done, but we continue to run the trial. So I'm linking that to the discussion on diversion. If we can, or Gordon can just talk to the expenditure on OSD. Unfortunately, we don't have control over it. This is a corporate services managed activity. It's administrative, because it's purely assessing in terms of OSD, as you know, the number of years experience one has, and then according to the timetable allocating that person to a particular BN. It's purely administrative. And Gordon and the acting CEO will explain what occasions that. And then Karen, if you can also talk to the point, the first point the honourable member raised as well. And also please cover the vacancy rates. Thank you.
Thanks, NDPP. If I may start, I did mention earlier on that the overall vacancy rate is 15.3%. But that was the overall vacancy rate that includes corporate services. But for prosecutors specifically, the vacancy rate remains 12.7%. But it doesn't change the point that the honorable member made, that we need to relook and change our recruitment strategy to attract more and more people from outside. I think we're trying to do it with aspirant prosecutors in particular. But I concede that we need to do a whole lot more to reduce the vacancy rate and report back to the committee. On OSD, I think there are about 788 people that we should be paying on OSD. To date, I think we have processed about 648, and about 140 people have been processed. We have unfortunately encountered problems with personnel in particular, because we had problems with personnel codes, but all that have now been overcome, and we are certain that at least by end of April, everybody would have been paid. Mr. Holomby can just give a reflection on how much money we have spent to date on ASD.
Chairperson, thank you. We have paid just over 50 million rands to about 648 people. That was on the 28th of March this year. We're still processing as much as we can before the end of the financial year. The amounts involved is not significant, so it's not millions of rands. It's rather small amounts. It's notches here and there. In some cases, there's nothing, even though the person believed he did qualify for OSD. So the expectations, I believe, were higher than the reality. The levels of experience did not match the qualifications. Chairperson, if I may, I would also like just to respond on the question on machinery and equipment to Pretoria and the other office. The expenditure on machinery equipment exceeds the budget limitations, and this is as a result of the classification of our finance leases. Our finance leases needs to be classified between the split between capital and interest. It's because of that split between capital and interest that there's an overspending on the capital side and an underspending on the goods and services side. We are fixing that through journals at this point in time, and that situation will be addressed. So it's a classification issue.
I mean, because now are we being told that now it's all sorted out? Because you know, your own annual report, your budget, your own annual report notes that in 2009-10, as during 2010-11, the budget in respect of compensation for employees was underspent. Your allocation was reduced by 111.6 million, which is quite a lot, I think, as a result of the non-implementation of phase two of OSD and the delays in filling funded vacancies. That's from your annual report, page 63. At that time, it was noted that the delays in implementing OSD had, quote, to some extent dampened the spirit of prosecutors, close quote, and that, quote, the NPA had to move with speed and ensure full implementation of the dispensation. That's on page 5 of your annual report. Now, can I just get clarity? Are you now saying that you have implemented OSD?
Yes, Chair, we have implemented OSD. We have received approval from our minister after consultation with the Minister of Public Service and Minister of Finance. So we are now implementing it.
No, I'm wanting to know, not are you implementing, have you implemented, past tense? You know, is it completed?
We are implementing it, but it is not completed.
When will it be completed?
End of April, I think we would have done all of it.
End of April.
And the unspent stuff will be spent by then?
No, I think some money has to be surrendered. I think the remaining pool of people will still not be paid by end of the financial. Will be paid from our baseline, and I'm saying it will be done from our baseline because it will be a very small number of people, and I think the money will be very minimal because it will only be about 140 people.
So I can then just respond to the other two questions. The first one relating to the fact that there is a difference between the E&E and our strategic plan, we'll go and check that. It probably is just a typo as indicated there. We sincerely apologize for that. In terms of the definition, in terms of the now National Treasury Guidelines, you actually have to do a thing called a technical indicator description, which is very, very useful. It's at the back of the document. Each of the indicators are actually defined. So there's a difference between a conviction rate, which is measured, if you look on our annual plan, if I can refer you to page 26, and you see that a conviction rate is the percentage of cases finalized with a guilty verdict, including Section 57A, divided by the number of cases finalized with a verdict.
excluding diversions, obviously. So that is a conviction rate. Now, in terms of that, in other words, those cases which you actually take on trial and which, as a percentage of those that flee and get finalized, what your conviction rate is of those ones. So in those cases, our conviction rate is very high. This target that we've set ourselves is not a conviction rate. It's the number of convictions measured against the number of new cases. So in the regional court, we do actually enroll cases as a first forum in the regional court in many of the places that we work in. So there are a lot of cases that do get withdrawn in the regional court or are not finalized within the regional court through a trial process. There's also a little bit of ADR in condogamy. So this is a figure measured against the number of new cases coming in. It's not the conviction rate figure. And that's why it's different in terms of it. And we feel that it's important to start looking at this figure as well and to start seeing the impact that we're actually making as an organization. So, as I said, the technical indicators is that give you a full description of how every indicator in the NPA will be measured.
Thanks, yeah. I mean, I do understand about conviction rates and finalized cases, where there are verdicts. But I still don't understand this huge disparity in the figures. I mean, I would be interested to know. I wasn't aware that the figures, the cases are being enrolled in the regional court as court of first instance. I haven't heard come across that before, but if that is now being done, can we get figures of it? Okay. Because still, I mean, you have, yeah, I'm, can we get the figures of how many and why that is being done? Because the advantage of there were fewer regional courts, so the advantage of the old system was that you enroll in the magistrate's court, you deal with issues of bail and matters like that, and then it gets referred to the regional court or the high court when it's ready to proceed for trial. Because that's a big jump, mm-hmm. and I'm not clear about why there's such a gap.
We can get that later.
Yes, Jefferson, we can give you the data on the numbers later, but you must understand that we're not in charge of the court role. So it's for the magistrates to decide. And it's, we found now that it's a tendency of some not to want to have it channelized in the district courts, and we do believe that it is a better approach. But as you know, we're not in charge of our court role. But we can get you the full figures of in how many places it's working, and it's not always the same. You know, they try one and then they try different one. We can get you those figures and send it to you.
All right, fine. Steve Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. Could I just suggest again, like we did yesterday, that the full documents, the budget report that we should have already received comments on, maybe we can furnish that to the department. The benefit is we have the quarterly meetings, which are very useful, where we obviously were able to follow up further issues. But can I say, in October, your report, you said the NPA is functioning in trying times, which are not conducive to service delivery excellence. The already overburdened prosecutors are being stretched to the limits in many areas and are trying to operate in a dysfunctional environment. Now we need to assist you in this regard. We need to come alongside you and see, is the situation improving? How can we assist the NPA? But then if we look at your budget, some of the issues have already been raised. My concern is underspending of your budget. And according to our researcher, your underspending was 175 million or 9%. Could you comment on that? And it seems that a degree of that related to the delay in implementation of the phase two of OSD, which resulted in your allocation being reduced by almost 100 million. Now, on the one hand, we're trying to assist you, but on the other hand, by not filling your vacancies, your budget is being reduced. It's a great concern to me that your budget annually has now been reduced from 2.68 billion to 2.64 billion, if I understand it correctly. And it seems that there is a degree of blame to be placed on the NPA for the underspending, and then, of course, the OSD side. So if you just comment on that for me as to how we can assist you in that regard. Tied up to that, obviously, one's got the qualified audits, which when you look at qualified audits with underspending, it seems to indicate there is a challenge with financial management, and I'd like you to comment on that as to what steps have been put in place to address this. When are you expecting a clean audit? Are you expecting a qualified audit for this 2010-11? And is the financial management issue affecting service delivery at the NPA? Let's see how we can assist one another in that regard. Then the second
issues that I'd like to raise with you is the issues of the DSO. In your annual report, you say that the placement of prosecutors was previously attached to the DSO, the Scorpions, and investigators was on course. At that stage, the investigators hadn't all been placed across. What is the situation in that regard? I presume that's all been finalized, but what is the working relationship now with the Hawks, with the DPCI? Is there a dedicated prosecutorial component that assists the Hawks? And then following on the Glenister case, whether you'll be making inputs as to the independence of the Hawks, whether you've got views on that, whether there's consideration from a policy perspective as to the placement of the Hawks under the MPA or in terms of a Chapter 9 institution to ensure the independence of the Hawks, which was a shortcoming that was highlighted by the majority judgment in that Constitutional Court judgment. Is there discussion around that policy issue? And then lastly, Advocate Simulani, you mentioned about the, some cases that you'd like, and I'd also, you do refer to those in your annual report and we can engage further, but one of the cases in the media is the Czech case, and of a concern to me is the allegation of prosecutors being on a hit list. That obviously is a huge concern to us. What steps are taken in such circumstances to protect the lives of such prosecutors and at what cost? Those are just a few comments. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Member Stuart, thank you for the input. You know, in respect of OSD, if I can just clarify one thing about OSD. It's purely an admin issue. You know, the people are there, especially phase two. Phase one has been completed. It's done. I think we finished it by even December last year. Phase two, it's going to affect very few people, but people that have been in the establishment longest, because it's purely their translation from where they are to where OSD identifies that they ought to be. And it's that movement. So the reason why it's not completed, it appears to me that administratively in corporate services, we just haven't finished identifying the right thing. I know that prosecutors are contesting the identification of the experience, because remember, we have to take into account somebody's experience. There are people who are, for example, saying, take my experience as a lecturer, as part of legal experience. You know, and there's a question whether OSD intends to do that or not. You know, so people are including, for purposes of being considered, all forms of experience that they previously had before even coming to the prosecution to say it must be factored in. So that is what is creating the biggest delay from what I could gather. But it's a purely administrative thing. So where honorable members will see a reduction in the budget, it's because that OSD is not going to, in a way, remain provided for, in a way, permanently. It becomes just part of your ordinary compensation of employees with time. What we're given a specific allocation for is to deal with the old stuff. It was purely backdating. So once you've done the backdating, then it's not there for the future. It's just part of your normal salary bill. So that's why there will be those types of discrepancies. Gordon, I don't know if I've explained it correctly, so that honourable members are not too worried about it. I think the lack of finalising it has a demoralising effect for some prosecutors, so that's at least the agency that I think honourable members correctly point out we should address. The issue of placement of prosecutors and investigators from the DSO, that was completed a long time ago, so it's not an issue in the NPA now. So those people are continuing to operate. So I don't think honourable members have anything to worry about there. Safe to say, you know, some of the investigators that didn't migrate to the police stayed in the NPA, and currently they are assisting in the AFU to conduct some initial investigations. Now, what that brings for us is the legislative framework, because in terms of the NPA Act, as it stands, we shouldn't be having investigators. We should not be having investigators. So it is a problem that they're there. And it has to be corrected. And one of the ways of correcting it is to actually move them to the right place, which is the SIU, which conducts investigations. So the NPA has no investigative capacity of any nature. So there's no reason why they are there. So that is the only residual aspects, I think, of that transition that still remains. And I think there's just about 50 people that are affected. So for now, obviously they are not affected because they do work and they assist and they do reasonably good work. But in terms of the law, we don't have investigative capacity when we shouldn't have it and we shouldn't tolerate it. So we have to deal with that particular aspect. There are many suggestions on the way that some colleagues are making to say, let's maybe make a proposal to say, let the legislation be amended to provide for prosecutors, but in the AFU instead. But the question is that, investigators. But the question, what will investigators do? Because the financial investigations is work that's supposed to be done by the police. That's the capacity the Hawks has and is building. So what we sought to correct by saying the NPA should only have prosecutors and not have investigative capacity, to the extent that it's got this particular grouping of people, has not been dealt with. So, we're trying to manage it and have it dealt with thoroughly. But the individual is obviously not affected because their work continues. But legally, it is a problem. It is definitely a problem. There are dedicated prosecutors for the Hawks in all the regions. The Hawks are still finalizing their setup in the regions, so we're waiting for that to be finalized. But in the meantime, we continue to provide them with prosecutors. The prosecutors at head office are geared to support them for their national office projects that are run out of Hawks HQ. So we've got that capacity. But through the anti-corruption task team, to which we all belong, with the Hawks, the SIU, and so forth, we're also building additional capacity. And we're pleased to have received support for additional funding from the CARA Fund for that exercise. And our strategies are being finalized, but for ongoing cases, we do have capacity. So there's no case where it can be said it's not moving because there isn't either an investigator or a prosecutor. So we're quite comfortable with that. I think the Glenisa case, from my understanding, it will come through the formal channels. Obviously, when our views are sought at that stage, we'll give them. I just wouldn't really want to be in a position where we preempt discussions. My reading of the judgment, though, quite clearly is that the Constitutional Court criticized the scheme of a ministerial committee. A lot of people identified that committee as being a committee that came into existence with the Hawks. It's not correct. That committee existed with the DSO. Remember, there was a ministerial coordination committee? It actually did meet. No. I think with the Hambepe Commission at the time, it was established that I think it did meet four times. That's my recollection, but subject to correction. But it definitely did meet. So that ministerial committee was there. So the advancement that comes with the Constitutional Court judgment, it appears, is that all it is saying is that it may not be, in certain institutions, the best approach to have a ministerial coordinating committee for investigators. And that's the implication I see for the Hawks. So it's a judgment that would have come in this way, whether or not the DSO was disbanded. So it applies to that old scheme, it applies to the current scheme. It's the way the courts have interpreted it. I say, of course, it's because it was the first time it was even brought before the committee. So the ministerial committee was there before and it's there now, but we'll follow those processes when those structures deal with it. But that's just the reading that one has of that aspect of the judgment. Of significance as well, in addition to this, is the fact that the scheme for the disbandment and the creation of the DSO of the Hawks was found to be constitutional, at least. So I think it's unfortunate that obviously different interpretations get given to the judgment, but I think from a policy perspective, it appears to be a reasonable judgment, and government, the prerogative of the executive to structure government in the way that it prefers was confirmed in that Constitutional Court judgment. But the court is saying certain aspects must still comply with the Constitution. So there's positives to take from that particular judgment by government.
Thank you.
This point, now that honorable member raises it, maybe I should mention it. It was going to come in subsequent reports because we're still engaging. I don't think it would be appropriate to talk specifically about the Mr. Kretcher's case, but to the extent that there definitely is, from the briefings that I've received from the police, a threat against that individual prosecutor, the problem is widespread in the NPA. There are a number of prosecutors that are currently subject to police protection or are currently subject to protection from private security firms. We have seen a trend, even in places where one would not have thought something like that does happen, where prosecutors do get threatened quite seriously for the work that they're doing, and we've had to seek this. And remember that this is not the costing that we would have ordinarily factored in. It comes as an extraordinary cost during the course of the year, so it presents a bit of a problem, but we're able to, from the budgets, deal with it. It appears to be on the increase. As of last month, my recollection was that the money that we're currently spending on the protection of prosecutors is just about 2 million, which is a high amount. It's quite sad that it is there, but it's 2 million. So together with litigation towards cases, it is something that we're looking at closely, and there will be a way in which we put firm proposals about how we think it should be dealt with. But it's hard to predict because we just don't know. Sometimes it comes across as a serious threat initially where protection is provided, but subsequently it turns out it's not such a great a threat. But in other cases, it becomes a permanent feature of that case until such time that the case is completed at least. So it's something that's there that we are watching. It hasn't reached the stage that I think is of alarming proportions, but I suppose one threat is one too many, and I think we have to try and keep our eyes on the ball as far as that is concerned. Thank you, Chief.
Dr. Devere.
Yeah. Thanks, Chief. Just on the two questions that were raised on underspending, I think our underspending, as the previous indicated, it's mostly on OSD matters as well as compensation of employees insofar as vacancies are concerned. And I think the committee can assist us by monitoring how we do. I think in the first quarterly meeting of the new financial year, we will be able to report on the progress that we're making on the two issues. On the issue of audits, and whether the financial management challenge is affecting service delivery, I think the NDPP correctly reported that on the key issues that were raised in the audit, one of leave, we are comfortable that leave will be able to complete, the leave audit will be completed. We are comfortable on the issues of irregular expenditure as well as fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and he has already indicated that disciplinary processes are underway. Our main worry really is on assets. The only thing that worries us is assets. We have already hired about 14 interns to assist. You'll recall that initially our historical problem with assets was that we did not have an asset register. Now we are in a position where we have the asset register, but the challenge is to verify that what is in the asset register can be found in reality. And the AG has already raised some concerns in that regard, and we are already worried. So we are working towards a clean audit, but quite frankly, I think our assets worry us. Whether this issue is affecting service delivery, I think the NDPP has already indicated that insofar as cases are involved, we do have prosecutors, we do have investigators. So to that extent, it's not affecting service delivery because most of the issues we are talking about are in fact historical issues. I think the one other issue on the audit was the Rentworks matter, on whether Rentworks was really a contract we used to use in the past to procure our vehicles as well as IT equipment. And the Auditor General previously raised queries about whether we received value for money. We subsequently conducted a forensic investigation on this matter, and it was established that we received value for money. And there are engagements currently going on with Treasury as part of the condonation process. I know that our Director General has also been writing to Treasury and so on this matter. So we don't think it affects service delivery, but these are historical issues that need to be resolved. And our main issue, our main worry at the moment is assets. Thanks.
Chair, just a small follow-up on the issue of prosecutors and the DG. Simulon, you indicated that it seemed to be on the increase, the level of threats to prosecutors and the cost. There has been reports in the media about concerns from the Hawks side about allegations of people from crime intelligence compromising investigations on organized crime. How does that impact on your concerns around prosecutors' safety? Is that a concern for you as well, the allegations that the Hawks are raising related to crime intelligence? It would appear to be leakages from certain members. I'm not saying the truth about it, I'm just saying, but surely this also is a concern to you as the NDPP when it comes to the safety of prosecutors, and how does one then address that issue? Thank you, Chair.
I think with respect to any member of the JCPS cluster who is acting contrary to what is expected of them as members of the JCPS cluster, it will always just be a concern, just as a matter of course. If such allegations are indeed correct and are indeed true, and certainly if they are established, obviously the law would have to take its course in that respect. You know, the threat to prosecutors is always, we believe, designed to make the case not run the way we would want it to run. Either the intention is to intimidate a prosecutor to the point where they are not able to run the case themselves, which would always be a setback for us, because then we have to start afresh with somebody new to run the case. So it's always going to be a concern. But in order to be able to deal with each threat very thoroughly, we try and look at the facts of each case. We try and look at the facts of each case and identify what is sought to be done. But by and large, in the cases that we've got, it's organized crime cases throughout the provinces. It's organized crime cases that involve this. There's probably one or two corruption cases. And I know all of them. I just can't give the details here. So it is a concern, but as I said, it's not such that it's making it impossible to work or difficult to work. It's an unnecessary nuisance, if I can say, at this particular point in time, because we have to worry about it when we could be worrying about something else. I think when it reaches stages of proportion where I believe something more serious ought to be done, then we will deal with it slightly differently. But certainly, you know, whether it's another prosecutor that's corrupt and leaking information, or a member of the police, as the case may be, whenever that happens, it severely compromises the case in ways that many people actually never imagine. It's actually usually fatal to a case. So whenever something like that happens, it's a major concern, and would expect that in those environments, they'll take the necessary steps when they identify such incidents, definitely. Thank you.
Dean Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Advocate, I studied your presentation of a strategic plan with a distinct sense of deja vu, because it looks exactly like last year's, and you have in fact confirmed that it pretty much continues the road of restructuring, except that on your view there is misunderstanding between us. Chair, if you'll just allow me to recap and very briefly. Last year, when the organogram was presented to us, which this year you find on page 5 of the presentation, I asked why the heads of the specialist units, which are so important in the fight against crime, had been cut off. The heads had been cut off, the asset forfeiture unit, the SCCU and so forth, and their staff were now destined to report down the line in the provinces. when I revealed to the minister, to his visible shock in our committee last year, that you had announced that the AFU was to be disbanded, he said he was going to see you immediately, which he did, and he stopped the disbandment of the asset forfeiture unit. When I raised the matter in the House to the President, especially around the SCCU, the President answered in short order that he was stopping all restructuring, pending his agreement with the Minister on performance outcomes. By August last year, I had the clear impression you were still restructuring, but you'd invented the concept of the dotted reporting line, which I see the asset forfeiture unit now labours under. And after that, we had the agreement between the Minister and the President, which I see from your presentation, the relevant part is outcome three, which now governs how you work with the NPA. And outcome three is the one that says all South Africans will have a warm, safe feeling. Now, if I may be honest, it escapes my understanding quite how that governs any form of restructuring. I know you have sub-items underneath. Crime must be reduced. Investment must be attracted by asset forfeiture. Anyway, South Africans must now all feel very nice and safe. And this appears to justify your restructuring, which is now, I take it, no longer your unilateral restructuring, but I take it this is now done with the sign-off of the Minister and perhaps the President, sir. That's the first question. But then I'm going to ask you how you can justify this. What we have now is the heads of sexual offences, priority crimes, specialised commercial crimes, witness protection, reporting to Advocate Ramaite. Is he not with us this year? They report to Advocate Ramaite. So they're there, but they report to him, and he reports to you, and they are detached from their actual staff, their units, correct, who now report to somebody called a coordinator. Now, where are these posts coming from? You don't at present, I think, have coordinators at the provincial seats. So there's a whole new ball game. They report to the coordinator, who reports to the DPP, who, of course, controls his or her own affairs under your overall guidance, except for Mr. Hofmeyr, who is the one who rejoices in the dotted reporting line. His people must report to the Attorney General in the province by the report by the dotted line. So I mean, I still have the same questions. I want to ask you now how this is justified. When, I mean, some of the staff are there on contracts, specified contracts. For example, the tax specialist prosecutors. You have a contract with SARS. The NPA hereby undertakes to establish a specialist tax prosecution capacity within the NPA in the form of specialist tax unit, the STU, whose sole and exclusive mandate is to prosecute tax offences. That's a deal with Pravin Gordhan when he was still running SARS, and that was 2003. Presumably that stands. That being so, how do you justify that the tax specialists now stream in under specialised prosecutions, isn't it, alongside sexual offences? But, I mean, these are people specifically appointed. The same applies to the specialised commercial crime people. The SCCU is created under presidential proclamation. Those people were appointed and interviewed on specific criteria. They have specific job descriptions. So how can you then justify? Is the proclamation to be rescinded? Is it to be amended? Have you made a deal with those prosecutors who now find themselves reporting to a coordinator of unspecified description in the provinces? So justify those to me. Also justify to me on structure how your intention to shift the support services to the DOJ is continuing when it is the government's strategic position, and I quote from that document, the strategic plan for 2011-2016, at B3 on page 11, strengthening the independence and the accountability of the NPA by providing, among others, a legislative framework that establishes the NPA as an entity accounting separate from the department. That is the government's goal. Why are we shifting the entire support services over to the DOJ, which of course is under this act, the accounting authority. So then secondly, and please I need some answers here, how would you justify this restructuring against results? And I don't have them, you have them. But on the first quarter performance, and I'm concentrating only on the SCCU and the AFU, on the first quarter performance after you started your restructuring, the SCCU had a drop of 26.7% in cases finalized, a drop of 22.9% in cases enrolled for trial. The asset forfeiture had a drop of 81% below the previous year on the value of new restraints and a drop of 21% on new restraint orders. That's the first quarter result. And I do not have, or I have lost, the second quarter, and only you will know the third quarter. But can you, what do your results look like? Is the restructuring reducing their performance? Is it enhancing it? And so forth. Thank you. So that's that question. And then I want to respond to just your other, you're effectively really asking us to ask you about cases. I suppose that follows upon the fact that you believe attorneys general ought to be in court prosecuting, and you yourself have done some since we last saw you. You are right in saying that the Act allows this, but what the Act allows us to do, I'm not sure it should, but it allows us, when holding you to account, to discuss with you decisions regarding the institution of prosecution. So, I mean, I'm going to leave it there. I suspect Dr. Ambrosini may want to ask you about the Savoy case and others. You may wish to be talking to us about Mr. Eugene de Blanche and others. I'm not sure I'm going to issue a general invitation to discuss cases, but I draw to Dr. Ambrosini's attention the fact that you could ask about the institution of that prosecution. But sir, please, may I have answers to these questions which bother me a very great deal? You have continued to restructure. I take it you now do it with the blessing of the Minister and the President, because all South Africans must feel safe, warm and fuzzy. And you have to explain to me how that fits under the Act. I don't think it does. How it sits under the SARS contract, how it sits under the presidential proclamation, and what results are we seeing, please?
No, thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Member Smart. No, indeed, you must feel safe, and you must be safe. That is this administration and this government's goal, and it will be achieved. If there's any way in which we can assist people feel that way, please, you should not hold back. Let us know, and we will definitely advise. So we will do the best we can to make sure that objective is achieved. The last question, if I can start with it. You know, the prosecution policy is approved by, it's tabled in Parliament and it's approved here. And the reason why I raised that point is because it does become important at some stage for the members of Parliament to be aware about how some of those types of matters get dealt with, you know, whether it's in line with the prosecution policy and so forth and so forth. So the actual scheme around it, I obviously leave to honourable members to consider and advise in due course. So it's something that I thought is important that we do raise. But in particular for cases that are concluded, not those that are sub judice, because we really can't discuss those. But where the matter is gone and it's finalized, we can reflect on it. The issue of restructure, I do say, Honourable Member, again, that I think this is a misunderstanding. For example, there's nothing new that's being done. What you didn't have in the past is, for example, on this slide 6, a framework where our prosecutors are organized. So in the past, what you'd have is that the DPP office take this route where everybody's a prosecutor doing a little bit and everything that's available in that office. All that I've done, I've said, take all these prosecutors, but if you look at the work that we do in the different schemes, let's separate them so that we dedicate cases. Take that portion of the table, that third, to deal with specialized type of matters. Take the middle portion of this table to deal with general prosecutions. Take the other part of the table to deal with organized crime cases. And take another part of the table to deal with the administration of the office and of governance. That's all that has happened. So there's no change. It's just emphasizing that certain areas must be looked at in a dedicated way, so that we're able to respond appropriately to each of these issues. Now, there is a huge benefit to this, because in each office of the DPP, we now know which are the prosecutors that deal with organized crime. For example, the case of Mr. Tutoi, for example. He's in the organized crime component in the office of the DPP at South Gauteng. So they're a group, a unit of... So all cases of involving organized crime that fall within that jurisdiction, those are the prosecutors that deal with it. So for everyone, for accountability, we know who's responsible for all those types of cases. Then you can see which case is allocated to which prosecutor. But there's that group. Similarly, if there's a commercial matter, we know in each DPP office which group of prosecutors are working with specialized matters, including tax matters. So under specialized prosecutions, you have your advocates that are dedicated to dealing with tax matters. We have those that are dedicated to dealing with sexual offense matters. We have those that are dedicated to dealing with environmental cases and so forth and so forth. So we know who they are. There's that block. Then you have those that deal with general prosecution, everything that comes, you know, that is not categorized as organized crime or specialized or, you know, or falling under the SCCU, as it were. They deal with those. Now, in terms of case resource allocation, general prosecutions in all jurisdictions constitute the largest chunk of the work. It's the largest chunk of the work because it's your basic scheme. So that's always been there. So there's no restructuring that has been done. It's always been there. All we've done is we've just said we want to allocate our resources in this way. So there's nothing new. That's why I'm saying it's a misunderstanding, because the fact that you've put it in this way, which for our purposes enhances the environment, I think it gives it another interpretation. And I'll say it's not a restructuring. So this is not an issue. Now, why the reports to the DPP? It's because the Constitution says so. The Constitution only recognizes two. It recognizes the NDPP, the office of the NDPP, and it recognizes DPPs, nobody else. You know, so that's the scheme. No, not the Constitution. The Constitution purely recognizes those two. So the structure of a single prosecuting authority in the Republic has to reflect those two offices. That's why in this first slide you then have the office of the NDPP. That's a constitutional requirement. You have it. And it's always been like this. It's never changed. It's exactly been like this. Those four, SOCA, PCLU, SECOW, Office of Witness Protection, have always reported under Dr. Ramayide. Always have. Nothing has changed. And then as you can see, there's Mr. Hofmeyr, the in charge of the AFU. That hasn't changed. So it's exactly as it is. All that you are seeing, we put it this way so that everybody knows what the office of the NDPP looks like. They're all here. In the past, the other two deputies were not yet appointed, so they were vacant. And during the time of the DSO, you'd have read Mr. McCarthy there as another one. But other than that, it remained exactly the same. Trust me, exactly the same. So you don't have to really worry about that. If anybody is telling you that there's a restructuring, trust me, they are using you for something, and I wouldn't really want you to be put in that position. I wouldn't come to Parliament. No, there isn't. That is the situation. So it's like that in all of this. The dotted line, the reason why this remains the dotted line, it's because, remember that forfeiture proceedings don't come out of the NPA Act. They come out of the COCA Act. So quite clearly, they are a different scheme. So they... People that are working on poker restraints, they're not doing criminal work, they're doing civil work. Because asset restraints are civil. It's a high court application by way of notice of motion. It's not a criminal process. It's not a criminal proceeding. So that line is there. They're here. What we are saying here is that because they deal with cases that are of a criminal nature, they bring a civil proceeding, which is a second part of a case, they should give information to the DPP about progress on where the restraints are. For example, in our strategy, we say we want so many cases where there's restraints, right? Now, the process is only beginning when you restrain, remember that. That's just the beginning. The end game is that the assets must then be realized permanently so that they get taken by the state permanently. To restrain is purely to say don't use, don't sell. It's nothing more. It's a beginning of the process. But how do you end up taking those assets permanently off? You only do so when your prosecution is finished. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's why you have curators. So the relationship... No, absolutely. No, don't worry about it. Willie's not worried. Why are you worried for me? No, this bit is there. I can't take it any further, Chair.
That Ms. Smuts's problem is... Is page 5 is the national, okay, the national office, and you've got then the green of DPP there. Then when you turn the page to page 6, you've got the provincial, and the national doesn't feature on here, okay. So whereas what may be easier if the NPA were to do one chart with provincial and national. Because it would seem to me that the sort of joint of if you look at page 5, your SCCU person is reporting on page 5 in the red box to the SCCU to Advocate Ramaite, but they are also doing a reporting to the provincial director, and it's a joint thing, and it presumably has to be that way because they're a specialized unit, but the decision about prosecuting gets taken at a provincial level. You know, so in other words, if I'm a accused in a specialized crime matter and I want to make representations regarding my that I shouldn't be prosecuted, I would go to the provincial director, okay, not to the national director, and you know, so I sort of see that, but it seems because she keeps saying, you know, where's the reporting to Mr. Hoffmeyer? Mr. Hoffmeyer is not on page 6. Mr. Hoffmeyer is on page 5. And maybe if you put the two together, it might make it easier.
Please save them the trouble. My difficulty is not with the picture, the organogram. I happen to have a view on what is actually going on, and this picture reflects what is going on. My objection is against the restructuring that you have done. It's not against the picture. Thank you, Honourable Jeffrey, for your attempt to assist. But I couldn't care less about the picture. I know what's going on.
No. Also to assist, the office of the NDPP has an SCCU, which is where the special director would be. Do you understand? And the special director, that component currently does SCCU prosecutions. So it already is there, you know. So in terms of that proclamation, so it is there. The office of the NDPP has its own SCCU, which does that work. So this structure then becomes in line with the constitution in respect of those two offices. No, I think they're talking about what's his name, Chris Yoda. No. He left. I think during cause late last year. I think that's when he requested to be relieved, and he was relieved. That's how directors do get relieved. Unfortunately, it's not an NDPP decision. I suppose it's because we knew that he had put in place that motion to leave. Yeah.
Right. I hope you don't remember this. Thank you, Honourable Smuts, for stopping. The Honourable Adams has requested a tea break, and I'm agreeing to it for 10 minutes, please, Honourable Members, just 10 minutes. There is coffee served, fresh coffee and tea outside.
You could say what money the criminal is going to commit the crime. whole thing is going to come up a big crowd, which is a great thing, but you can have a lot of money. But let's stop her. I think we've got to go to the value of no,
days ago.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, can we please come to order? That includes Christine and her team. All right. The next person to direct questions at the National Director is the Honourable J.B. Sibanyoni.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mrs. Melani, mine is just a brief comment on the issue that you have said. The question of the practitioners, some being absorbed by the Legal Aid South Africa and others being absorbed by the NPA. You know, these people are equally qualified and the like. And then I will agree with you that it seems not really fair that the two institutions are not paying those people the same salaries and the like. I think from my side I support the view that in fact the Legal Aid South Africa should also be paying the same because they do the same work. And more especially in the fact that, you know, in the past it was only the prosecutor who was doing many cases per day as attorneys. An attorney will do only one case, because if you do two cases, the former lawyers on my side here can bear with me, you were in trouble for double briefing. Yes, you are not allowed to do that. Yes, but now when you go to the courts, you find the legal aid practitioner having a lot of piles, and then also of from time to time, when a person says, "I want legal aid attorney," you must stand up and consult quickly to find out, does this person qualify? And if there are more than one, is there no conflict of interest and the like? I think they're doing quite a lot of job of smaller. And then, but let me just mention this difference. You know, your prosecutor is backed by the police. The statement is taken by the police, the investigators and the like. But this legal practitioner from the law, Legal Aid South Africa, he takes down the statement himself or herself. He consults himself and must be ready to do all those cases one day, more than one case per day. The old cases he was bringing in court, and the new cases that will be coming in for people who say, "I want legal aid." That's all I want to comment, Mrs. Melani.
Uh, the Honourable Debbie Schaefer, followed by Dr. Ambrosini, and then Nkosi Holomisa.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Several issues of concern for me are, firstly, the issue of your cybercrime. I'm glad you finally got a strategy about cybercrime, but when you look at your statistics on page 14 of your report, performance plan, you're telling me that you haven't had one successful cybercrime prosecution finalised this year or last year or the year before. I mean, we all know the state of cybercrime as exists. How can it possibly be? And do you really think that the provision that you're making for combating cybercrime is sufficient? Because, I mean, your figures for dedicated prosecutors I see are very, very low. And you know, we all know how this type of crime has increased hugely over the last few years. That's my first concern. Secondly, you know, I mean, what have you been doing in the meantime with cybercrime? I mean, what's happened with the cases? And can you give us any idea of how many cases there are actually in existence? Are you still commencing prosecutions? Have you got any on the go at the moment? Secondly, the issue we raised with you last time we saw you was on a sexual offences course, and you were going to come back to us with some kind of idea as to what you were going to do to assist in that respect. And given that the figures were far better in the specialised courts compared to you know, in the normal courts, what resources have you allocated towards that? Because it doesn't look like, from what I've seen in the budget, that there's particularly much. Then I just want to ask you on your plan, your performance plan, on page 8, why does the estimated performance for 2010-11 seem to be lower than the previous years? I mean, it's 36%, which is higher, but it's a percentage of a lower amount. Why is that happening now? And then also on page 9, how is it that your value of assets linked to corruption and fraud frozen is naught this year, whereas previously it was 5 million rand, next year you're estimating 1 million and then 2 million and 3 million. Why is it now this year naught? It's the second one from the top. And then just lastly, I'd be very interested to hear your reasoning behind your decision to prosecute the children in the Jules case instead of going immediately to diversion. If you could comment on that. And what the result is up to now of that. As far as I understand, they are now diverted. How is that progressing?
It's not sub judice, though, is it? Is it a done case?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Chef. The cybercrime, when the issue got first raised, you know, I think it got confused unnecessarily. And what we've been trying to identify is exactly the point you're asking: to what actually are we talking about? What it appears it is. It's really crime committed through either the internet, but at least using a computer. Somebody, they look at a computer, responds to that, and then loses money. Your typical 419. So we call that cybercrime, and then thus present it as if it's some complete sophisticated new crime. It actually isn't. It remains a basic fraud, but what is a challenge is the presentation of electronic evidence in court. So we have been dealing with many cases involving electronic presentation of evidence in court. And if one looks at how we define cybercrime, we actually have been dealing with those types of cases. So it comes across as if we're talking about a completely new crime. It actually isn't. So what we have seen and picked up is that we do have a need to train our prosecutors more on the litigation skill of presenting electronic evidence in court. Now, we're not going to do that on the basis that we're responding to cybercrime. We have to just do it in the normal course. You must be able to present any form of evidence before court. So that's how we're going to tackle it. But what you see now in the plan, those figures talk to our attempts to at least have specially trained prosecutors in each place who'd be able to assist with further training. So at least we're saying, whilst everybody has to do it, let's try to have at least two people in each DPP office that are specialists so that they can help train other people and so forth and so forth. That's really what we're talking about. But on the actual cases on the ground, It just depends on whether or not somebody is faced with a challenge in court and they have to deal with it. So those who are less skilled at knowing rules of evidence and presentation of electronic evidence, then they have a special problem. But we believe no prosecutor should not know the rules of evidence and how to present it. So we train all prosecutors equally. So it's just that it comes across in that way. So your 419 scams, we continue to deal with them and people continue to be convicted. So it really is that really about this. Sorry? Yeah, and we deal with it, the cloning of cards, credit cards and so forth. We deal with it in the normal courses as fraud. But it is done by the SECU from a specialist perspective and also seniority perspective. So that continues to be done. So those statistics are there. With respect to sexual offences courts, well, the progress that I can record is that again, we just continue to engage with the magistrates to say, because the problem is there. It's them not allocating enough dedicated courts to deal with these cases. But I understand to some extent their challenge, and it is that the cases that are ready to take to court, in some courts are not as many to justify one magistrate just waiting for those cases to come to court. To be honest, there are many cases reported, there are many cases that get investigated, but some of them get stuck in between the investigation and presentation to court. So some do get dealt with by way of mediation, or some we're not able to get the evidence that is enabling us to believe we can succeed in a prosecution, so maybe they get withdrawn or they're not proceeded their way. But the actual challenge of not having dedicated courts, I think it should be unfair to make it look like that is the cause for some of the drops in the statistics. It isn't. But what we do argue, and we would support comments that have been made in the past by honourable members, it's where we say, when at least there is a sexual offence case that's brought before court, ideally, the best trained magistrates to deal with sexual offences should be the one that deals with that case. That we agree with. But that is not always the case. So even if there are few cases, we're saying, yes, let there be few cases, but whenever that case has to be dealt with, at least the best trained magistrates should deal with it. So those are the types of issues. The magistrates, obviously, as you know, they would continue to say magistrates need to be able to deal with all sorts of cases the way judges do. We have no qualms with that. We agree with it, but would like some element of special attention paid to some of these cases. So that really is the issue there.
Max, if I can just follow up on that. You say that that's not the cause of the drop in statistics. What then is the cause in the drop in statistics?
Yeah, we think it's investigation related. You know, the cases that do get reported, some of them we're just not able to take to court for a variety of reasons. We have gotten to learn that especially cases involving children under, I'll say, 10. We're not taking a lot of those cases to court. Rather, we allow the social workers to assist the child get rehabilitated. There's a special problem with cases involving, the younger they are, the more difficult it is to prove, and it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it, you know. So those are the challenges that we face. Karen, can you deal with the issue of those figures, those numbers?
Yes, so we'll deal with the figures. Just also in terms of the backlog, the dedicated courts, at the last stage we did mention to you, sir, Chairperson, that we were also going to do research because we were concerned about the figure in the dedicated courts. We believe that might not be totally dedicated because we're getting closer and closer to the original court conviction rate. In fact, the research has confirmed that. So the figure in the dedicated court, which looks very good and has been reported very good, is actually a figure that also involves other cases, which therefore influences the good outcome that you got. So therefore, in the current annual plan, we therefore are going to remove that figure and look at it in all courts. It's also important to note that in some areas, a lot of the cases are sexual offences in the regional courts, and therefore it's important that all the courts equally seek to achieve a high target in terms of a conviction rate for these kind of cases. So that is what we'll be driving in our annual plan this year, is to make sure that all courts, we're going to record the data on sexual offences in all courts, and we're going to look at the conviction rates there to make sure that justice to the women is, and the victims of sexual offences specifically, is served in actually all of our courts. We want to have equal there for everybody. In terms of page 8, you spoke about the figures there. As I indicated earlier in my presentation, when we did this, we had to do a projection of where we're going to be. So you'll see that at that stage, it was a conservative projection. I can give you the figures up to February. In fact, it is 25,468. And the number of convictions, the percentage there is 36.6. So on our target of on that is quite close, but the number is more. And we still have 1 month to go. So we should be more or less, we should reach more or less what we did last year.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think that...
I take it in your answer you dealt with the Jules High.
No, I didn't. The policy position that I have concluded is best for us to be consistent in this, is that, you know, when you do have a case involving children under 16 who engage in a sexual act, yes, depending on the facts, but it is important to be consistent and deal with them equally, and therefore charge them, have them charged. The effect of saying that they should be charged doesn't mean that they're not dealt with in terms of the charges. All it means is that the matter must proceed to two courts and be dealt with in terms of the Child Justice Act, where the usual happens. The social workers come in, and eventually it really would get diverted. If you don't take that decision to charge, what you are basically saying is that it must be solved in the office, administratively. And my concern with dealing with cases that way is that there's a lot of opportunity there to not deal with matters properly, because you are leaving it to just the individual parties with the prosecutor to decide it in chambers. And I think there's a greater risk for our system there if that is done. The advantage of insisting that it be done in court is that it's transparent, it's judicially supervised, but it follows the normal processes, and we still achieve the same outcome. So the proper implementation of our Child Justice Act is important to be done in that way. That really is what informs my current approach about charging them. Yeah. Thank you.
Dr. Ambrosini.
Mr. Chairman, see, being at the end of the first round, one is neither left with the silly or the controversial questions that I have. I usually ask the controversial, but I ran out of political latitude to ask controversial things. I'm not going to ask about the Savoy case because I have a conflict. I know the man. But I discussed it with the shadow minister of justice, and she should perhaps, because it did raise a shadow. But in any case, it raised an issue of who got charged and who didn't and why they didn't, and what the entire thing. But again, I'm not going. I'm going to ask a couple of silly questions in terms of policies. I dealt with three or four cases which have been brought to my attention in which lower-ranking prosecutors refused to prosecute on account of a civil action being available. And I accept that one can't prosecute everything and one needs to develop strategies. But is there such a policy, and if such policy exists, in choosing what to go after and what not to go after, how does one deal with it? And that's at the lower end of the formulation of prosecutorial policies. At the higher end, and again, I accept two things through you, Mr. Chairman, sir. The first is that one must have a prosecutorial policy, because we cannot go, you cannot go after each and every crime, you cannot stop each and every car speeding. And the second thing that I accept is that we are in a stage of democratic consolidation, and there is a paramount interest in the safeguard of the Republic. How far can, is there a spoken or unspoken of policy of not going after crimes committed by people in high offices? And which, I mean, perhaps you cannot answer the question, but I need to ask it nonetheless. When there is the option to go after them, is there a spoken or unspoken policy that one can just go after the underlings and send the message out, so that perhaps that which is corrupt could reform itself without shaking too dramatically the very foundation of this new republic?
The issue of civil action being available, I have also come across those instances when people make representations where prosecutors say that there's a civil action available. In almost all those instances, we have advised that let the prosecution continue, especially where the complainant insists on a prosecution, you know. We appreciate that prosecutors are independent when they make that, you know, prosecutorial decisions, and if they've exercised the judgment to not prosecute, we understand that. But when somebody, you know, makes it a representation point, we then are able to intervene through those measures. Sometimes it's informed, the decision informed by just, again, a lack of appreciation by the prosecutor that it actually is not a civil matter, it is a criminal matter, because sometimes they make decisions thinking it's a civil matter, not a criminal matter, as opposed to choosing the other one against the other. So we do deal with those things. There is no specific policy that says that can be done, so it's something that you just see. With respect to crimes committed by people in high office, I'm not aware of any spoken or unspoken policy. As far as I know, and as far as I've dealt with matters, every single case that has, in my view, warranted a prosecution, at least that has been brought to my attention, I've always indicated that those cases should be prosecuted. So I suppose decisions that are made by local prosecutors will always be informed by the evidence that they believe they have. And I don't know many cases, I mean, if there is one that you're aware of, I'll gladly respond to it. In the past, since I joined the NPA, I think I've received about 8 to 9 representations, not more than 10, where they don't involve people in high office, but where people have sought to have asked the NDPP to intervene and deal with the matter administratively, because they believe that it is a matter that is being negatively influenced either by the prosecutors or by the police, as the case may be. In all those, I've never agreed. I've always insisted that those very same points that you make, you can actually make in court, and if they're correct, you can succeed. So I have a policy that says, you know, we should never deal with matters by way of administrative process unless it's one that involves a violation of the Constitution. If there isn't, it's just arguments that somebody makes. They're best dealt with in a court of law. So as a matter of course, there's no representation that I've agreed to of all those that I've received. So just to indicate to the Honourable Member the approach that is taken to these types of things, because there are opportunities that people do raise, you know. But there's no such unspoken or spoken policy that I'm aware of, at least within the NPA. I wouldn't be able to speak about other places. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. My questions would be informed by my long absence from this committee. and also the judicial system in which I've been raised. On page 4 of the slides, you refer to successfully convict 100 people by 2014 that have assets of more than 5 million rand restrained. With this number, 100, where does it come from? Are these people who have already been charged, or is it people with a number that is likely to be there from now until 2014 that then you will have wanted to have successfully convicted, that I'm prosecuted? Where does it come from? And yes, the next question is on page 9, it relates to page 9 of the slide, where you talk of providing a service that ensures that justice is delivered to the victims of crime. Well, what does this mean, delivery of justice to victims of crime? Because I said from the judicial system I come from, the justice is not limited only to the charges being laid against the criminal charges being laid against the suspect, but also restoring what is due to that person that has been taken away. Now, I understand that it has been a practice, a tradition from since the system we are working under was introduced, that there's a separation between criminal justice and civil justice. We're talking transformation, Chairperson. I don't know whether this applies only. This is a matter that the NDPP should be answering to, or whether ourselves as Parliament should be. That we're talking about transformation of everything, including the justice system. And this practice of prosecuting a person criminally and then leaving the victim of the crime to fend for himself or herself in order to recover what has been lost as a result of that, it doesn't seem to be complete justice to me, because it involves the person now having to raise funds in order to ensure that he recovered that what has been lost, the damages, if you like. And I know there is the principle that goes that the standards are different in the other system. There's a balance of probabilities and stuff like that, and in the other one there's proof of guilt beyond doubt. Now, it would seem to me that if the difficult standard has been achieved, that is of proving guilt beyond doubt in the criminal case, it should make things easy therefore for the state to go to the logical conclusion and ensure that the civil justice is also achieved in the same process. Why must we continue to separate this just because previously or originally they were separated? Because, as I say, in my system, there's no such distinction. You just deal with the matter criminally and to its conclusion. Any thoughts on that? Lastly, Chairperson, improving support to victims of crime and increasing engagement with the community on security awareness. No, it's not necessary. But it's a last question relates to the question of the Constitution. Somewhere says there shall be equality before the law, equal treatment of persons before the law. Now, the NDPP has stated that people who have money are able to manipulate the system. They are able to stall until such time that they are able to come up with a strategy that they believe is going to suit their interests. Now, now it does seem to me, Chairperson, that if there are two, there's a person charged, the accused, and then there's the victim of the crime, and the accused is represented by a lawyer who has more qualities, who has more skills and abilities than the prosecutor, then there's no equality of treatment in that particular setup. Should it not be that if there's a senior counsel on one side, there must be a senior counsel on the other? At all times, that there must be quality of services. Doesn't it amount to injustice to the one who is represented by a less qualified lawyer? I'm saying these things. I don't think they have been looked at from that perspective. But it does seem as if to me it negates the quality that we're talking about before. Before the law. So there was one matter that I had marked here. Oh, the last one, Chairperson, was on page 23 of the slide, where there's reference to corruption on the part of the people involved in the system itself. I understood that to mean that it could refer to some prosecutors being involved in corrupt activities. Can you indicate the extent to which this malice obtains and what is being done about it? Because you do talk about the need to develop some framework and things like that to ensure that there are checks and balances, and also that there's been a lack in disciplining those that are concerned. What exactly, can you elaborate a bit on that as to the extent of that problem and what it is that is being done to address it, rather than merely talking about the need to develop and implement some frameworks, because this is a matter that obviously has been going on for some time. Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Chairman, could I possibly piggyback on one of Nkosi's questions? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was one thought that I found very thought-provoking in what Nkosi said in terms of reform, and I would like to put that to the Director of Public Prosecutor, how he would feel if the system were to move in that direction. There are countries in which within a criminal trial the victim can propose its own civil action, so that the judge hears the same facts once and has got in front of him effectively three parties. Has got the defendant, has got the prosecutor, and has got the lawyer representing any civil action that needs to be interposed in respect of those facts, any claim that arises out of those facts. That complicates the trial itself, but it simplifies the system because you've got one set of facts, one adjudicating process, and it's somehow similar to the system of indigenous and traditional law that Nkosi was referring to, and is quite common in continental Europe.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable members, Honorable Olomis, I think you've raised questions that are actually very difficult, in the sense that it's that there are so many different views about them, and the demand for some mechanism from government is immediate and is huge, and government is only able to deal with some of these things in part. I'll give my perspective from my experience, having been also the accountable officer and being on this side. On the first question of 100 people convicted by 2014, this is a figure that we believe will fairly represent a large number of cases of corruption involving this amount. It's not all cases involving corruption, it's cases involving specifically that amount. If you take into account the fact that there's many cases reported about corruption and people benefiting from corrupt activities, when we've started looking at the actual benefit to each individual, there are many cases where they fall below the 5 million. So as a result, if by 2014 we are to meet the targets, it means by end of this financial year, by end of this month, by end of April, we should have convicted at least 20 people. We're unlikely to make the target. Simply because the cases are available that talk to that particular target are still running in court or are being investigated. So they will not be finished by the end of this financial year. So which means the figure moves to the next financial year. By the end of the next financial year, we must have convicted 40 who have benefited to the tune of 5 million. So it's clearly becoming clear that it's a very difficult target to meet, because people that are bribed, they rarely get given 5 million. They rarely make 5 million. It's 300,000, it's 400,000, it's 1 million. You are lucky if you find somebody who's benefited to the tune of 1 million and above. So we've interpreted as the NPA, the police, SIU and others, that this figure is really talking to people that have really made a killing, for want of a better expression, out of corruption. You know, and we're expecting that those are the matters that would come forth. We've currently identified only 37 such cases before the police that are currently under investigation, some of whom are already in court, early stages. Now, cases like that take longer because now those are the people who really, really fight. So it's we're not underestimating this task. In fact, we're actually worried whether or not we'll meet it, because those are the time-consuming cases in terms of time, resources. You know, it's the type of case where you allocate that prosecutor to deal with the case and nothing else, which we're struggling to afford at this point in time. But that's what that figure talks to. It's a figure that was rounded up in the discussions to say what can be a good indicator. And 20 cases a year appeared low enough to be able to deal with the problem. So these are your high-value corruption cases, but low volume, that you are targeting at. In the statistics that we've seen, there are more cases falling below 5 million. And that's why in our strategy, you see others, we were talking about restraint, 1 million, 2 million, and we're progressive. So that we're saying, if you don't get enough that meets this target specifically, let's, however, capture those that fall below. So it's a difficult figure. Delivery of justice to victims of crime. This is an attempt to respond to the cry that all that the state focuses on is the accused person, and we do enough to indicate our empathy to the victims. They just come as witnesses, and when we're done with them and we pay them witness fees, off they go. There's no way in which the system embraces them, as it were, you know, to the point that the accused even has the benefit of free legal services in the form of legal aid. So this is an attempt to say we will respond to that cry by involving the victim as much as possible in how the case is dealt with. It's not the best area of our work, because it's also difficult to monitor, because individual prosecutors approach cases differently. But what we try and do is that we say, however you're going to resolve the case, at least you must consult with the victims and find out how they feel, find out if they agree that the manner in which you're approaching the case, they believe, you know, enables them to appreciate what we're doing. Because once we agree that we don't have to agree with them and they don't have to agree with us, but at least if they understand what we're trying to achieve, there is a sense that they're involved in their own matter and they're more receptive to whatever process we eventually end up putting in place and whatever outcome we're able to achieve. So we try to do that. And dealing with matters by way of restorative justice in part is one way to accommodate some of those matters that involve family members only and can be addressed in the family context. Cases that we deal with by way of mediation, also they involve family members or people that live within the close communities. The challenge lies in what the Honorable Jeffrey raised, that maybe there's a need to have some regulation that everybody can see. Right now we're using our own internal measures, you know, part of the prosecution police or part of the directives. But it may be something that needs to be addressed in law, you know, so that you can marry and take it even further and marry our mediation processes or restorative justice processes with, you know, traditional courts because we've provided for them, and they've even been, traditional leaders have been provided with jurisdiction. So what hasn't been done is to find a way in which those talk to each other. Currently, one operates separate from the other. You know, we've just given, if I recall the legislation correctly, the draft, is that the government has just given traditional leaders jurisdiction to deal with certain type of crimes. So that aspect can be looked at to say maybe there should be a greater engagement in cases that at least involve those communities before the prosecution is able to finalize. So we can look at it as a prosecuting authority by way of policy directives that you can put in place to try and start mirroring this. But it will also be important that we consider in the medium to long term a specific regulation that becomes part of the Criminal Procedure Act. Incidentally, probably the biggest problem in the system is that, I suppose, like a church, everybody reads and preaches from the Bible, unless you are of a different faith and you look at the Quran and that type of thing. Similarly, in the legal system, everybody reads the Criminal Procedure Act. If it's not in the Criminal Procedure Act, you actually struggle to argue a point with anybody because they simply say, "Where is it in the Criminal Procedure Act?" Magistrates tend to do that. So if it's not a Criminal Procedure Act, you struggle. You can say it's a policy, it's this and that. If it's not in that book that is carried all the time, then you struggle. So some of the things we have to remember that we pass, but we need to make sure that they find reference to the Criminal Procedure Act, or they find themselves also referred to in the Criminal Procedure Act. Then people feel mandated to have a look at them. I've picked that as a challenge. Compensation orders are not probably adequately utilized as they can. Honorable Olomisa, the challenge really that we have noted as well lies from the committee. You are also the problem as honorable members, because we're insisting that the executive produce these conviction rates. You see, you keep insisting that what is the conviction rate? We want the conviction rate. Now, how that gets interpreted on this other side of the fence is that I must take this matter to court and get this conviction, or I must have a plea and sentence arrangement that gets me this conviction, because if I don't get the conviction, I'm a failure. You know, that's how we have positioned the system to operate. So if we are going to start bringing in these other elements, because they are new, they are forward-looking, the natural instinct of a police official or a prosecutor is not to go for them. It's to go for the usual that we know, that I know I'm a winner. If I get a conviction rate, you know, I'm a winner. You know, so it's trying to, I think we're being driven in the right direction, you know, as governments, to say this is all contributing to our constitutional value system. So it's the right thing to do, actually. Conviction rates can't be the most important thing. So we're moving in the right direction, but unfortunately our history is the first point of reference when you look at the system. For the judiciary, our history is the first point of reference. As I said, it's the Criminal Procedure Act. If you don't have to toy, you don't know what you're doing. So in a way, we have to find a way in which some of these things start getting changed. I'm not certain how best we can do it, but until that gets done, then we're going to keep having this debate over and over and over again. So maybe we need to start emphasizing other things. That also talks to the issue of transformation. Yeah, the fusion of civil and criminal justice in resolving disputes is going to present its own challenges. Yes, it's ideal to resolve the matter once and for all at that particular location. Again, it's a function of history that we've separated these things, but you can definitely fuse them if your restorative justice framework works well, if your mediation framework works well, and then you add to it what is currently available in the form of compensation orders works well. It's how we want to measure the system. You know, for as long as we are measured on the other things that are traditional and historical in sense, we're going to move slower in the direction that the honorable member argues we need to start looking at. So I think it's a policy issue that the executive must take note of and then naturally drive until it becomes either legislation or at least there's another way of dealing with it. So definitely regulations are required. For example, I know some people who disagree. One of the saddest things in dealing with prosecutions is seeing how people's lives get affected. You know, with drunken driving, yes, as a society we frown on drunken driving because of the problem we have and the problems we have. What do you do when it's a 19-year-old university student, just caught at a roadblock, no accident, nothing, but they just drove drunk, or he just drove, or she drove drunk? You get prosecuted, the matter gets settled, you get found guilty, and there's 300 rand fine that you pay. Your life's gone, just like that. Yes, you can say you should have been responsible and not driven drunk, but yes, it's correct, but by nature of youth, you know, you want to give people like that a second chance. So we don't have a probation system in South Africa that first says, you know, almost like diversion for children. For children, we've created this to say, let children first go through this system, and only those that are unrepentant do you punish. But for adults, you don't have that. So you have good citizens who just make a mistake once in their life on something minor. I'm not talking about those serious things, something minor. We don't give them a second chance in this country. We actually make them criminals, you know. So I've seen that in the context of the drunken driving cases, but there are other cases. You know, so the issue of restorative justice mediation has to take a different dimension, and it has to be the dimension that changes the way society looks at crime. I mean, again, if you look at the police, the first instinct, arrest. Police are measured on how many arrests they have, you know, and it's a problem, and it affects our backlog. By the way, if you look at the Crusher case, Mr. Crusher appeared in court on Monday. What's today? Wednesday. On Monday. Now, for backlog purposes, the matter is under investigation. In 6 months, if that investigation is not completed, that's a backlog. Because that's how we've defined backlogs. If it gets transferred to the regional court and the investigation is still underway, if 9 months later it's not resolved, it's immediately a backlog. So the reason why, and the point Honorable Jeffrey raised last time, in fact, he asked the question, are we winning? And I said, I don't think so. It's because of that. The system is not geared towards winning on backlogs, because for every arrest that gets made, you then have 6 months if it's a district court, or we have 9 months if it's a regional court, to get it completed. And we know investigations don't get completed in 6 months or 9 months. So we've inherently measured, put a measurement that I think we're going to struggle for a long time to deal with, because that's how the system rolls. So if we were to change it, we'll have to look at it slightly differently. So we'll reduce the numbers, but whether we'll get to zero, I think we may be stretching it. So again, you know, mediation, restorative justice, dealing with that framework that Honorable Olomisa is talking about, maybe just one other way to fast track time frames and create that efficiency. Equality before the law, how to deal with people with means. Mr. Crusher is allegedly at some point said, the reason why I came to this country is because it has the best constitution in the world. Because I suppose for everybody, you can stretch the limits, you know, it's a minefield for opportunity. So anybody takes an opportunity with the system. If it's true that he said that, well, maybe it is true, it is the best constitution in the world, but it's how we use it, it's how we interpret it, and obviously the court will guide us on that. Now, we should therefore accept that as a downside of having the best constitution in the world is that it's going to be tested over and over until such time that the law is settled. So people have a right to do that, and magistrates use that in the context of bail to say the constitution talks about liberty. So why should I deny somebody the fundamental right in the Bill of Rights to liberty just because you're accusing them? They're innocent until proven guilty. So you're the one that must make a case. So they release them. The challenge then becomes, if it's a fifth, tenth, fourth time the person has committed a crime, why does it keep happening? To what point does that right get limited? Schedule 5, Schedule 6 offenses, where the burden shifts a little bit. So the fundamental change has not happened in the minds of the people working in the system. And in some cases, there is a fear. So part of the contributing factors to this is probably the way even politically we engage on these types of things. Sometimes the politics cloud the actual facts on the ground, and as a result, people become apprehensive, they become nervous, they become anxious, and they don't want to be the first ones that get caught up, and they'd rather postpone or leave this thing. So we pick those things up. So it's important to note that that is the issue. Legal aid South Africa, and we've supported them at the NPA in one case, I think it's the Portage case, where they were appealing a decision by a provincial division of the High Court, where it said the defendants must be given legal aid, but of the same status. And legal aid challenged this, and we supported them in that. We can't do it. The status of silk doesn't mean you're better, because the way you are measured is to obtain silk is more than just performance as a lawyer. It's other factors, your contribution to the to the bar or to the legal system, as it were. So it's not a measurement of your ability and confidence. I mean, the NPA has many good prosecutors who succeed against silks, but then they themselves are not silks. So it's a bit of an unfortunate measurement that we have put out there as a system. So I can't remember how the case eventually got settled in the SCA, but we hope the legal aid succeeded, because the state was never going to be in a position to afford this. So yeah, it does present a bit of a difficulty, but the challenge then is, at least as a prosecution authority, we must just always make sure that our prosecutors, even our lowest ranking, is at least competent. That's the minimum we can do. If they're not competent, then we suffer. The extent of prosecutor corruption, we don't have as big a problem as other departments. So we're fortunate in that respect. What are the figures currently?
20. On the baseline report, it was 24 cases, which is 0.6%.
Yeah, it's 24 cases. Currently have 24 cases. Now, those are the known ones. We don't know the unknown ones, you know. But the known ones are 24. It's a small number in relation to the overall percentage of staff, so it looks great. But I'll submit that one corrupt prosecutor does, it's one too many, and does biggest damage. And I can tell you how this thing generally happens. It's not about just getting money to make an important statement go away from a docket. It's about using the process in a way that you snooker the system. In other words, I can determine the outcome of a case at the beginning in the way I deal with it. It doesn't matter what happens in between. It can go and run in court, but I've long determined the outcome just in the way I dealt with it. So one person that does that can cause huge problems. And there are cases where we have dealt with them internally where we've been very suspicious. Unfortunately, it's not nice to be suspicious of the judgment of your colleagues, but you start saying, this choice could not have been the best under the circumstances. And some of the areas where those things have come up is in the conclusion of 105A plea and sentence agreements. It's in the conclusion and determining who's a 204 witness. Because once you do that, it's done. And typically, for a 204 witness, if you want to mess up the case as a prosecutor, you simply say to somebody, give me your statement, I'll consider whether I make you a 204 or not. And you say nothing more. The person incriminates themselves in the statement that they submit. You look at it and you say, I'm not satisfied, I'm going to have you charged. Now, it may look like you've done the right thing, you've made the right decision to charge, but you've interfered with the process because you can now use the same incriminating evidence against this particular person. So you've effectively made them get away with it. You know, so that's a way in which you can look at it in the system and make somebody get away easily. Now, who's going to say, I did it deliberately? You'll never be able to prove it. But from peer to peer, you'll be able to look at it and say, the way you exercise that judgment was wrong. But whether you're able to elevate your suspicion to a definitive finding, you have a problem. But the damage is done. So there are many of those types of things that we struggle with every day. So integrity is not a question you can regulate. It's not something you can regulate. It's not something you can legislate for. It's just something that you can hope that people's consciences are in the right place. Unfortunately, not for everybody. So that's the extent. Fortunately, we don't have a big problem, Honorable Olomisa, and those that we have, we're dealing with. But in many cases, we ask 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 questions and we frown, but we let it go because you can't prove anything. So I think the questions by Honorable Ambrosini, I've responded to, in a way, in the way I dealt with Honorable Onomisa's questions. Thank you very much.
Before I recognize your follow-up questions, I just need to say something very quickly, please, to the media. I'd like to think that I respect your rights to be part of this process, that I understand and even empathize with the cynicism with which you look at some of us. But I do take exception when some of you enter this room and sit and read newspapers. I admire your multitasking skills because you're able to listen to what is being said here and the obviously unimportant issues that are being raised whilst you are reading your morning newspaper. I don't like it. Please, don't do it in my committee room. Please. And that applies to all of you. Thank you. The Honorable Swart and the Honorable JJ have requested an opportunity to do follow-ups.
Thank you, Chair. Just one or two issues. We spent a lot of time talking about restorative justice, which we've always supported, and I think it's a way forward. And advocate, sorry, just to ask you, we're grappling with the issue in the trafficking bill, looking at trying to find a way to extend the Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act, that compensation order. Is it something that you've considered? As we've looked at the issue now of trying to bring in criminal and civil, we've already got the procedure section 300, which is very narrow. It's only for malicious damage to property. But is it not something that one can consider an amendment to that section to make it broader for compensation orders for a straightforward assault case, for example, as opposed to sending a person to jail or something, or finding a person, to rather have a compensatory order, and then that could facilitate your restorative justice diversion if one has a mechanism there for compensation. We've already got the basis there, but is that not something as a policy that one can look at? Which ties me into my next issue, which is you touched on the issue of adult diversion. You said that's something we should look at, and we would support you in that under certain circumstances. And I do notice in your annual report you did refer to a project that you've got in Wentworth Court where it seems to be working quite well on adult diversion process, but you obviously need a legislative framework, and I think that's what you're looking at, and maybe from a policy perspective we need to look at that. I fully agree with you, you know, one hit and you're out, and that person's life can be destroyed, and we need to find, we all buy into the concept of restorative justice, and maybe that's something that we can look into. But have you thought specifically on Section 300 on a legislative amendment to make that broader? It's a very easy, already magistrates are equipped to deal with Section 300, and maybe just to make it slightly broader. That's the first issue. Secondly, to streamline criminal cases, is there any further thought to, we had the issue of a senior counsel versus an inexperienced prosecutor or something, that inequality that was raised by my colleague. Is there any discussion around the possibility of the defense having to disclose its defense along the similar lines that the state has to disclose its docket? Now, we appreciate there might be constitutional problems with that, but has there been any thought further to take that situation beyond the mere plea bargaining, a plea explanation that we've got, to require the defense to disclose a form of discovery that would then facilitate a quicker, then you narrow down the issues. You have a, like in civil matters, you've got a discovery process. You can narrow, you can say, well, does admissions, you look at, and you can shorten the criminal case. If there was a legislative framework compelling the defense to disclose, taking it further than merely plea explanation, which also then facilitates your plea bargaining, because then you know exactly what is the basis of the defense. But I'm thinking further than your plea explanation, that is the present provisions. Then just lastly, I did pick up, and this is not exactly a follow-on, but I did pick up that there seemed to be a bit of a in your annual report, that there was a concern about a lack of
there was an absence, there was a concern about the Hawks and the Directorate, the PCLU. It's on page, the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, page 24 of your report, which says the absence of a formalized relationship with the Hawks in respect to matters which fall within the mandate of both the Hawks and the PCLU remains a challenge. And just something that we might pick up again with the later this afternoon. Is there anything there? Has that been resolved? Is there any problem there that we need to be aware of? Thank you very much. And sorry for, you know, thank you very much.
I just need to, before you begin, Advocate Simulani, honorable members, we have less than half an hour left. I have Mr. Jeffrey, the Honorable Adams, and Dean Smuts on my list. There is something, and the Honorable Shopistole has come back and said she must be still be on the list, which she is. There's a little matter of the how we deal with the traditional courts bill that I want us to resolve today, which doesn't affect the NPA in any way. So please,
we're meeting again this afternoon, that chair. So there is a depends on our time.
My fear is the quorum matter.
For this afternoon,
we have a quorum here. I hope we have a quorum this afternoon. So if you're saying that that's fine, then so be it.
Let's see our time.
All right, fine. I have you on my list.
Maybe we could take all the questions and respond one.
All right. Are you able to do that, Advocate? All right. Then it'll followed by Dean Smuts.
Mine is brief, and it's more as what I would see a wrap-up of the issues that I raised, and that was that the problem of statistics. It was something identified in our budget review report, but we need to move forward with that in terms of implementing it, ensuring that we have a common set of indicators. Then a complaint to the NPA on page 11 of your strategic plan. I did raise it in the BRR, but you've done it again, and you haven't given any explanation. And that is that if you look at page 11 on this document, okay? This document. Okay, your performance plan. Okay, and that is basically that you've dropped your targets. So if you look at number 3, High Court convictions, 2009-10, you had an 88% conviction rate. You want to drop it to 87. District Courts, 2009-10, you had a 91% conviction rate. You want to drop it to 87%. That's not right. Okay, I don't think we can accept that. That you your target is less than what you achieved. Okay, that's the one. Then your figures don't talk to each other. The presentation here that you gave here, slide 12. The increase in number of JCPS officials convicted of corruption to 63 by 2013-14. Now, you have elsewhere in your strategic plan, page 9. You don't have those figures. You've got a figure of 60. Number of JCPS personnel convicted of corruption. 2013-14. No, it's 80. So the two are not talking to each other. Please give us documents that do. And by the way, with regard to the point that was raised earlier, these, I think, are thumb suck. You don't know how many officials are involved. Hopefully, there was a talk now of 24. You're wanting in a few years' time to be convicting 80, 100 of corruption. Hopefully, as you start nailing people, the bad elements, then the figures will reduce. So I'm just a bit worried with that. And then lastly, on the stats issue, the vacancy rate. This is going back to that page 9 or page 11. Your and its number, it's Anyway, yeah, I can't find it now, but it's your figures are too are just much too high. Okay, number 9, prosecutorial vacancy rate. Your estimated performance for this financial year is 14.6. No, the past financial year, sorry, this financial year is 12%, but hey, you're already at 12.2. Okay, you want to reduce it to 10, 2012-2013, 8, 2013-14. Now, when the minister spoke about filling up the vacancies, I don't think he was talking about it being acceptable that there's a 12% vacancy. Okay, Legal Aid Board, or South African Legal Aid, I think they're on a vacancy of 4%, if I'm correct. It's in the 90s that they've got the posts filled. So we can't accept that, and I do think, Chair, because of this repeated problem, we do need to get more regular reports from the NPA and the department about the vacancy rate and what's being done to fill it. Last point, sexual offences. I think we do need to have a session with the NPA and maybe the Magistrates Commission on the sexual offences. Because the figures for sexual offences, I mean, whilst magistrates' courts, it's like in the 80s, sexual offences is 48 is the target. Now, we know it's more difficult to prosecute, but let's look at it. Let's look at engaging with the magistrates if you do need specialization. How you handle a rape complainant as a witness and what you allow the defense to, how you allow the defense to cross-examine her is a particular skill. I mean, as a presiding officer. So you do need specialization, and I do think we need to engage have a special session on sexual offences, because, you know, Advocate Smilani raised the question of, are we winning? I don't think we're winning on sexual offences. I don't think we're succeeding. So I do think we need to have a sort of special session on that, involving other role players, maybe the police, but definitely the judiciary in some form, whether it's the Magistrates Commission.
Dean Smith.
Thank you. I wish simply to add to Steve Swart's question. I understood from your documentation somewhere that a difficulty experienced by the Priority Crimes Litigation Unit, which of course is supposed to prosecute post-TRC offenders who didn't get amnesty or who never tried, and I think I saw reference to the fact that the Hawks are not helping them. Now, they can do absolutely nothing if the Hawks are not assisting them with investigations in order to prepare these cases. So could you confirm that and cast further light on that, please? I also never got an answer on the tax unit. Does a dedicated tax unit still exist as per the agreement with Pravin?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Maybe the question by Honourable Smart. Again, I think it's the internal use of terms. People say, I'm in this unit, I'm in that component, and so forth. I'd say, don't make too much of that, because it's the way internally people define things. But are there dedicated prosecutors to deal with tax matters? All those that have always been there remain, and that's what they do. So in our specialized prosecutions block that you saw earlier in the structure, in there are those prosecutors that are dedicated to tax matters, are those that are dedicated to other offenses as well. So they're there everywhere. The post-TRC cases, there is no problem here. I think that may have been a very old issue that was raised. All those post-TRC related cases were referred to the Hawks, and they were conducting the investigation. So my understanding, everything is going fine. We're waiting for them to come back to us. In fact, with Advocate Ackerman, we sent a detailed memo to the Hawks to advise them what they should bring back to us when they come back, and therefore indicating to them that they shouldn't come back to us unless each docket has what we've indicated in our memo it should have. So we definitely did have that. So there's no issue there. We don't have to worry about it. I agree with Honourable Jeffrey on the vacancy rates. Similarly, on sexual, on sexual offences. That discussion would help. We can produce the figures as we have them, so that they enrich that that debate. On corrupt prosecutors, the 24 are only in the prosecuting authority. The 60 is the JCPS as a whole, including Home Affairs Department, Department of Defence, and so forth and so forth. Correctional Services, the police. So those figures relate to different areas. But we're dealing with it here because it's a measurement that the JCPS class as a whole would be measured against. I agree with him. The conviction rate should stay the same. I don't know how we'd end up getting reduced. Can you just explain it? It is the same. It definitely shouldn't be reduced compared to the previous year. If there's something like that, eh? It's increased.
It's supposed to be increased, I think, is what the argument is.
No, it's the same. My understanding of Honourable Jeffrey's argument is that it shouldn't be decreased. When the point was raised last time, I argued before the honourable members that it may not be wise to keep insisting that it goes up. At least it's better if it stays constant. And what was then mentioned last time is that it's fine, but at least it should never be lesser than the year previous.
The percentage has dropped, but the actual number has increased. And perhaps that's where Mr. Jeffrey hasn't looked.
Oh, okay.
If you look at the number in brackets under three conviction rates in high courts, Advocate Simelane, the actual number has increased, but your percentage has dropped.
It's the same.
Well, the percentage has dropped. It's 88% to 209 to 10, and 210 to 11, it's dropped to 87, whereas the actual number has increased.
Yes,
so
yes.
I don't know. Anyway, I'll
maybe it's misread. Okay, right. But I take the honourable member's point on that, and we look at it and refine if necessary, and we look at the issue of statistics as well. Honourable Sat raises a couple of questions. To be honest, there hasn't been sort of a dedicated assessment of how this Section 300 can be amended to attend to the problems that you've identified. I suppose it's a good opportunity for us to go back and look at it. It hasn't been attended to, but I think we can put together suggestions quickly. Because it links to the point Honourable Olomisa raised around victims, in terms of the Prevention of Organised Crime Act, for restrained assets by the FU, we can compensate victims. So in the context of the Human Trafficking Bill, because human trafficking happens in the context of organized crime, if it's possible to find a linkage between that and poker, we can then say that the CARA fund, where all the money is deposited that comes from organized crime activities and that type of thing, can be utilized to compensate victims, and then a model sort of put together on how that can be done. So the CARA fund is already there, it's got money. Currently the money is spent on departments who make a bid for various crime-fighting activities. So what can be done here is to purely say that committee that advises cabinet on how that money should be spent can also look at how victims can be compensated. The challenge that I see you'll have is that for a trafficked victim, you'll have to identify things on which that victim can be compensated. For example, can you buy a house for the person, or find accommodation? Can you, and why that and not other victims? So the challenge that I recall around the proposed legislation on victims fund, those were mostly the issues that I think it was argued needed to be considered. And I think this will also still face those types of challenges. I think I've dealt with the diversion. The issue of disclosure of the defence, somebody will have to look at it in the context of the presumption of innocence. You know, why would you insist that I disclose my defence when I'm presumed innocent? Now, if the intention of the proposal is to assist the system move faster, I'll submit there are other things that we can look at and deal with to make the system move faster than this. For example, I think we can interfere with the rights to remain silent. You know, there's no reason why somebody should remain silent. You know, you don't have to incriminate yourself, but surely you can't keep quiet, you know. You have no other mechanism to to open your mouth, you know. So I think that aspect can be looked at to say at least be required to answer questions, but you don't have to incriminate yourself. That may be better, because through that discussion or that interrogation we can get information, or at least the police can get information and evidence that can assist. There are then other things that create bigger problems, like private practitioners double booking, not being available. The major one being, on the day of the trial, the accused fires a legal representative and you start afresh. So there must be a point where we say, you know, so many days before the trial date, you can't change your legal counsel. If you do, you do it at your own loss. You know, that type of thing. So make it difficult for people to change at the last minute. Those are the type of things that I believe can do more to assist the system move faster than dealing with these constitutional aspects. Maybe you can still be there, but minimized one way or the other. So those are the issues, Chair, that I thought I hope I've answered. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're fast running out of time. The Honourable Shobhis Tole, followed by the Honourable Adams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I am very, very much impressed by the vision of the NPA to achieve justice in our society so that people can live in freedom and security. To me, this is very fundamental. It is the cause for which we have fought for so many years, so that South African can feel safe. I remember when, as a child, listening to my mother always singing this thing, song that there shall be peace, freedom in the new South Africa. And it's very touching to my heart when I hear words like this being said by a section of a department. It shows that we are getting there. But I would like to say to you, Advocate Simelane, that you will only be able to realize this dream, this good vision, if you have got the resources to deal with. Without resources, and you know we don't have adequate resources all the time, we're dealing with a situation where we have got scarce resources, but a lot of work to be done. So I would encourage you to fill up the posts in the financial management section with competent people. In line with the call of the president, do fill up the posts so that you contribute to the job creation, which is the vision of government this year. I would also like to just advise you that in my parliamentary life, I've read a lot of annual reports, financial statements. That is my passion. I used to read for many departments in my province, nationally, and I even read for other provinces. I've realized one thing, that most people get qualified reports simply because they do not communicate properly. They do not communicate with the portfolio committee. You know, it's called a portfolio committee. I would like to call it a mother committee. Because a portfolio committee, you know, has got the interest of the department at heart. If the department does well, it tells a story about those members that serve in that portfolio. It is not a nice thing if your department lands up in SCOPA. It's not. It's very sad. It doesn't just tell about the department. It also tells about yourselves as honorable members. So I want to assure you that as this committee, we want you to have clean audits. That is what we want. So communicate with ourselves. We've got a system in South Africa, a legislation, the Public Finance Management Act. The emphasis on timeliness, timely reporting, quarterly reporting at least. Why do we say, why does the PFMA say we need to report on an ongoing basis? It is simply because financial statements are tools for management, to guide management. And without those essential tools, there is no, it doesn't matter what the name of your department is. If the finances are not correct, you're not going to achieve your vision. It is also necessary, in line with Chapter 2, Section 16 of the PFMA, to communicate what you are doing with Parliament and the and the Auditor General, so that the department, the Auditor General understands your thinking. Because I know if you're working, you'll always have be faced with situations where you have to use funds in emergency situations. You need to bounce at it with ourselves, and you need to bounce it with the Auditor General, so that we understand why you had to do that. That is why you find that because people are not communicating, they end up with the Auditor General pointing out unauthorized expenditure. You know, so I just want you to do that little bit of the communication. It doesn't matter how wrong you might have acted, come to us, we are the Mother Portfolio Committee. It doesn't matter with ourselves saying a lot of things, we are saying it in good faith. All the members who have been speaking now are speaking in the best interest of the department and the NPA. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just have a few questions, three questions. My first one is, currently we have xenophobia attacks, but the accused, if they are found, is charged with theft or assault. Then we have farm murders, and the charge again is murder. We have corrective rape of lesbian women. Again, the charge is rape. I want to know, are there any future plans to ensure that these specific crimes fit the charge and or sentence, especially given the fact that the common law and the statutory law does not provide for that? And then also, will these crimes ever be prioritized within the NPA? My following question is, during last year's Soccer World Cup, cases were heard and finalized within record time. Were any proposals implemented after this World Cup to ensure that cases are speedily finalized now, and that that World Cup and the finalization of the cases were not a once-off stint? My last question is that it seems like there's a general perception that the prosecuting system cannot be trusted. And I'll make a few examples. Mr. Simelane have made a few comments with regards to the Diwani case. There were recent appointments that raised eyebrows. Shabir Sheikh seems to be totally above the law. And I think worst of all is the outcry of South Africans with regards to bail. I think that not a lot of South Africans really understand the issue around bail, but also the undue delays in court cases, like, for example, again, the Jukjuk case. How does the department intend to deal with this specific perception? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Definitely on the issue of improving communication, it's something we're going to have to deal with, and we will deal with it. It is something that is always understated in any organization, when actually it's probably the most important thing, I think, with everybody for that matter, including the honorable members here. So we will deal with it as soon as possible. And definitely the filling up of vacancies, we will also try to speed up for them as much as possible, so that there's an improvement there. With respect to the incidences of xenophobia, corrective rape, amongst others, the way it is now, you know, if somebody has passed on as a result of that type of attack, we have to go for med. I think the honourable member is raising a point with respect to hate crimes. There isn't a specific definition of a hate crime at this point in time. and in fact even racially motivated cases escape. But prosecutors argue and can argue in court that the circumstances of the case are such that the crime is influenced by xenophobia, which is looked at in the following way internationally. So it can be argued so that those factors become aggravating factors and they can influence sentencing. That's currently what is available. In terms of specific legislation to classify these as hate crimes, I'm not aware of any immediate legislative proposals, but I am aware that the issue has been brought to the attention of the minister. And he did ask that we look specifically at the cases reported here in the Western Cape in respect of corrective rape, and we are trying to get statistics at this point. I've already engaged with the DPP, Advocate De Kok, on these cases. In fact, the most prominent case that's currently in the media, we've been discussing, and I'm happy that it's proceeding, notwithstanding that historically it's been sort of suffering under delays. So, yeah, there is that. There is another proposal. The legislation has been in draft form in the department. I'm not sure how far it's been processed now. That deals with prejudice specifically. I think the Constitutional Development Chief Directorate has been working on this in response to the WACA conference. If you remember, a couple of years ago, we held the World Conference Against Racism, and there was a need to get legislation to respond to racism specifically. So I know there was a policy, there was a ministerial committee, inter-ministerial committee that dealt with those related issues. So those issues, Honourable Member, are being looked at. I'm just not going to be able to give you the time frame at this point in time. Maybe we can come back later, but they are not forgotten issues. We did submit a report dealing with lessons learned from the World Cup, and we've tried and we're trying to use those lessons in other subsequent cases. Specifically the public service strike, we used the same model. We used the closest courts to where the incidences were happening with dedicated teams. So that appears to be now the rule of thumb, in that whenever there is a particular high incident of certain types of crimes happening in this country, we use that model. Fortunately, the teams are already in place from the police side and the prosecution side and the department side. Administratively, people are there. On the prosecuting system cannot be trusted. With respect and the greatest of respects, this is a problem for politicians, not for officials. I think it is a political discourse more than a government and the administrative discourse. It's very unlikely that any one of us controls the appointment processes and those types of things. You know, just like you don't choose your family members, you're not going to choose who's appointed when other people are responsible for appointments. I think the best thing is from our side as officials to accept it and move on and do the best we can in the circumstances. I think at the level of political parties, I think that's a different debate, and it can happen at that level in that space, and we shouldn't bring it into our space. The context of the Diwani case, again, if one has a look at the interview that I held, it was the context of discussing how extraditions work. And we're explaining there, you know, how these systems work and what factors are taken into account. And therefore, when we make mention of the fact that the NPA does intend charging somebody of a crime that the person has committed. In the South African criminal justice system, we know that everybody is innocent until proven guilty, but that is what the state will allege. Even our charge sheets, when they get drafted, they actually say somebody is guilty of something long before they are pronounced. So it cannot be correct that when we say that we want somebody extradited from a particular jurisdiction to come and face charges for a crime that that person has committed, who are prejudging the issue. We're simply saying, one, the person brought before court because we want to present our case for the court to make judgment. So I think it's something that was totally taken out of context. Bail is a different problem. What we're proposed to do, with your permission, Honourable Chair, to take forward the point that Honourable Schaefer raised, is maybe we submit statistics on cases number of cases were possible where this bail was granted. And I'm thinking immediately at least your Schedule 5 and Schedule 6 offences, which are your serious offences. Maybe we should bring statistics here to come and show how often bail gets granted, because we do have that problem. We actually do know. And maybe there could be intervention with magistrates, because that is the issue. There are no delays, ma'am, in the Jubjub case. The only reason why it didn't start the last time was because the prosecutor involved was hospitalized. He underwent a procedure, but it's now running, and we're confident that it's going according to plan and that we will succeed in that case. Thank you very much.
All right. I will take that as being your last word, Mr. Simelane. If not, then I'll give you a couple of minutes to round up if you need to. All right. Then it's for me to say thank you very much to you and your team. I'd like to think it's a bit difficult from this position of chair, because you're not neutral. You're sort of listening carefully. But I thought we had a very productive session, notwithstanding the disagreements we may have. Again, as in yesterday, Vonani, I get the sense that we should have allocated a day to both the government yesterday and to the NPA today. But be that as it may, we've covered quite a lot of ground, and it's enriched the discourse that we've engaged in. So my thanks to all of you. Honourable members, our meeting this afternoon is at 2. It's in room M514. It's not here. It's in room M514, which is in Mark's Building, which is the fifth floor in Mark's Building, right at here. And we're adjourned.
Thank you.